Oh, cool. There we go. Maybe they can hear us now. I think everybody can hear us now.
There we go. Okay, everyone can hear us now.
There we go. Freed, we figured it out, Freed. We can use the internet. Thanks, Poe.
it's about time.
All right.
You know?
Yeah, we finally figured it out. All right, so let's see. These 21 chatters, is there anybody? Freed, you know what? Can you write? Let's write if everybody can hear us, because I want to make sure everyone can.
Yep. All right, hang on. It sounds like everyone can hear us.
Beautiful.
And yes, so we're in the clear here.
I think we're in the clear here, man. I'm excited. Then I'm going to start with saying, you know, that thank you so much to everybody that's in this room. I know we've got like 85 or 90. I see there's 20 here. I guess some people are going to join later, or they're trying to figure out how to use the internet like you and I did, Freed. But thank you so much for supporting our books. I guarantee that Jason's book is going to be better than mine. So you guys are all in in massive luck. Freed, you got anything to say?
No, other than my book will be better than yours. But no, I can't ever say that. No, hey, thanks again. Thanks for having me. Gary, first of all, thanks for having me on here, because this is your idea initially. So I appreciate you having the faith in me to be part of this with you.
No worries, man.
This conference is being recorded.
I mean, Freed, we're so smart that we should probably record this, so I recorded it.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
All right, so Punk Rock Devil and Coder Path and ID35. Freed, you know, Jason and I can tell you right now that we have been dreaming about doing a Q&A tour for about a year and a half now. And this is the first time we get to play around with it a little bit, Freed, virtually, not in real life, but we're excited about it.
Yeah, it's a good first step. We've been talking about doing a traveling conference. We've even thought about doing something crazy, like doing a 24-hour nonstop Q&A live sort of thing, even maybe just doing it in different airports. So I thought it would be kind of cool to actually go to different gates in an airport so we don't have to rent an actual venue and just go to empty gates and do Q&A. People can come to an airport instead. I don't know, but this is the first step in that process.
Okay, so hold on one second. I'm going to call Marcus because I see somebody's got an access code issue. I'm going to call Marcus real quick. Make sure he pays attention. It does sound like an unconference click rhyme. Hey, can you hang out in the room a little bit? Because I see J.O. Ampus has an access problem. Can you just check, make sure there's a couple things? Thanks, man. Thanks. All right, so, you know, guys, for us, can everybody say hello? Because I see Click Ryan and Punk Rock Devil and Coder Path, but not everybody has responded. I want to make sure everybody's paying attention. Can we get a little hello from everybody? There you go, hockey player. There you go, Rye. There we go. Nice. Holla.
Hey, how's the audio quality, guys? Can everyone hear us all right? I know you can hear us, but can you hear us all right? Is it breaking up or is it pretty clear?
But it was clear.
All right, good.
Nice. Good. All right, so, Jace, you know, my preference and your preference is to go Q&A the whole way, right? So
I would like to do that. But I don't know if it's a bit presumptuous. I mean, everyone here knows probably who we are and what's going on, but, I mean, I don't – some people
– some of that might be fan viewers. Some might be a mind you, right? No, not necessarily, dude. You know, you're right. They may be – you tweeted it out, and there's probably people – no, you're much cooler than me, so I think most people know who you are. Is there anybody here who doesn't know one or the other of us? 2 minutes. Yeah, I agree. Go ahead.
Gary, your book's out first. Why don't you go ahead first?
Sure. I was born in Russia. I sold lemonade and baseball cards, got involved in my dad's liquor store, launched winelibrary.com in 1997, grew it from a $3 million local store to a $50, $60 million a year kind of business, launched Wine Library TV in 2006, became a pretty well-known wine video blogger, and in late 07 started talking about business, started speaking at conferences, gave a talk in 2008 at the Javits Center, Web 2.0, that kind of really, not necessarily put me on the map, but it was definitely one of the big talks. Ironically, it was Jason who was in the green room Jace, do you remember that day when I was like, something big's about to happen? Do you remember my energy in the green room that day?
You didn't know what you were going to talk about either. I totally remember that day. You went out and killed it. Crushed it. I'm sorry. Crushed it.
Thank you. And so I wrote this book, and, you know, just an entrepreneur. I love Jason Fried, and because him and I, when we first met, and we don't do this enough anymore, Fried, but like 2 o'clock in the morning on AIM, coming up with ideas. Jason and I wanted to do like the dollar store of the internet. Like, we just riffed. And very entrepreneurial, and I want to buy the New York Jets. Your turn, Jace.
All right. So I have a similar sort of background, although I was born here, but I've been selling stuff my whole life. And I can talk a little bit about this later, too, but I had a lemonade stand. I was detailing cars. I was mowing lawns. I was actually selling illegal things. I'm not going to go into that. But I also sold like stereo equipment to my friends and cordless phones. Everything I could find, I would sell. And when I was about 15, I got a reseller's license and I went down to the State of Illinois building with my dad, got a reseller's license, and then got a distributor's catalog called Ingram Micro, and I could buy stuff at cost. So I'd buy stuff at cost, I'd make my own catalogs, and I'd sell stuff to my friends. And I've always been loving the idea of selling stuff, finding stuff that was cool, that I wanted, and marking it up and selling it to somebody else. And so that's sort of how I got started, and I've been doing this forever. I worked for someone briefly for about 4 months of my life after I got out of college, but ever since then I've been working on my own, and that's just how I'm built. And so I hope that I can share some ideas with people about how I like to do business, which is different than maybe Gary likes to do business, and it's definitely different than other people like to do business. But fundamentally, my whole thing is that, you know, obviously just like Gary's, you obviously got to love what you do and everything, but I don't think that business needs to be this really difficult, huge risk-taking sort of thing, and I want to talk a lot about that tonight. So anyway, briefly, company's 30. Go ahead, Gary. Sorry.
No. I was going to say, hold on a second, Chase. Go ahead. Keep saying what you're saying.
Yeah, I was just going to say real quick, the company I own is something called 37 Signals, and we make a variety of web-based software products, Basecamp, Backpack, High-Rise, Campfire. And that's what we're doing today. We sell web-based software for small businesses. We write books. We do speaking tours, things like that. But that's sort of what I'm up to these days.
Yeah, I will say this, guys, about Jason. As some of you might know, I've now got involved with my brother AJ in a company called VaynerMedia, and I can tell you very quickly as we navigate through these waters, what Jason does, it becomes more and more attractive to me every day, because what Jason's always been good at, I've always been good at working ridiculously hard and probably harder than most people. Jason's just smarter. He thinks about scaling. And he's very good at that, and I promise all of us, including me, can learn a lot from him on that. But, you know, when it comes to this, I think what I'd really like to do is answer questions. So why don't, if you guys want to ask questions, why don't you start with, this works for me on Ustream, official question. So OQ:, and then ask your question, and then we'll start answering them. Jace, what do you think?
That sounds good to me. We'll keep out lookout for him right now, and let's get started.
Why don't you pick the first question?
If you want to address a question specifically to somebody, just using initials GV or JF, I think. But we'll just pick out whatever we think we might be better answering.
Do you think it'd be fun for both of us to answer so they can see we probably agree on a lot of things and we may disagree on some things?
Sure. That's good, too, of course.
All right, you pick the first question. Read it out loud, and then we'll both, and you answer, and then I'll answer, and then I'll pick a question. I'll answer, then you answer.
Yep. So far, there's actually only one question for you. Is your energy hereditary?
Not really. Ironically, my dad definitely is not as, you know, hyper or high energy as me, though he works really hard. And neither really is my mom. I think it comes more from my mom's side of the family, but it's hard to really tell, but I'm definitely not really like the rest of them all that much. Yeah, I'm not. How about you?
This question wasn't really directed at me, but I'll hit it up. I mean, I'm more of an introvert, so I'm a quieter guy. I like to stay at home. I'm not a big going out kind of guy, so I have a different type of energy. My energy is more about, I think, really staying focused on one thing. So, Gary, I mean, my read on you is you're focused on a lot of things. You love to be involved in a ton of different things. And obviously your love for wine is a clear focus, too. But you're kind of involved in a bunch of stuff. I'm more of the guy who's involved in just one or two things at a time. So I have a different kind of energy. But I think the energy itself doesn't come from, I mean, it comes from being interested in something that you love to do. You can't help but be energized by stuff like this. So that's where I think it comes from for me. I don't know if it's genetic or anything like that. It's just that I love this, so I do this. That's why I can't stop doing it.
I agree. I mean, you're right on your take on that. Jason and I are very different in that sense. And honestly, and I'm a big enough man to say this, first of all, I think everybody needs to execute against their DNA. I couldn't focus on one thing. It's just the way it is. But I have. Listen, I put my head down and built Wine Library, and that was 8 years and nothing else. I think there's a lot of success to that. I think I'm kind of going through like that, those high school years as an entrepreneur now, where I need to rebel and do a lot of different things. But ironically, Jace, next year is pretty much strictly about VaynerMedia and Corked, and that's kind of it. I'm going to travel less. And I do believe the way you go about things tends to have a higher success rate, because you really got to put your all into something to really make it work.
I think so. I mean,
No doubt. Let me just say one thing, guys. I see that some of the questions going by. All you have to do is control, copy, and paste them. This way, we will get to them systematically eventually, for sure. What's awesome about having this small of a group is we'll get to them. All right. I will. There's a good one. Dickbot says, how important is it going to conferences? So, Vic, here's my take on this. If you go to conferences for the content to listen to the speakers, I think it has very low value, and you're overpaying for the ticket price. But the networking is the game. And I would go to lots and lots of conferences and pay the ticket price just for the networking. I mean, that's what I did early on when nobody knew who I was in this space, and it was immense for me. So if you're somebody who's extroverted enough that you'll say hello to people and put out your hand to shake it first, I think conferences are massively valuable. Dave?
Yeah, you know, here's my take. I think you should go to conferences for a while, but then you should stop going. Go to be very selective, because I've met people at conferences who only go to conferences, and they actually never work. They never actually have any time to do their work. And I run into people like this all the time. And so I think I don't know if it's an excuse for them or if they're procrastinators or what, but you can find yourself being elsewhere all the time and not actually getting your work done. So I would say I totally agree with Gary that it's a great thing to do, especially early on, to start building a network. I mean, Gary, you and I met at South by Southwest. And, you know, I wouldn't have met you otherwise at the time.
Something real quick. We met in South by Southwest 2008, right? March of 08, right?
07.
Was it 07?
No, it was 08. You're right, 08.
And I just want to say that was still one of the highlights because, you know, for me ever, because for you to say you were a fan of my stuff at the time, you know, was very flattering and a big highlight for me because anybody in this room... Okay. Anybody in our space should be massively impressed with what you've accomplished. I think you stand out in a different way than a lot of people do. And yes, that is where we met.
Well, that's nice. I mean, I do think that you're right. It's totally a great place to go meet people and meet people you want to talk to and get new ideas and circulate ideas. But I do think you got to be careful and don't find yourself over conferencing because you'll never actually get anything done. So, you know. Start out that way, then get to work for a while. Then you can go selectively at conferences, and I think you might get more out of it that way, ultimately. So that's my take on it.
Good job, man. Take the next question.
All right. Let's see here. Punk Rock Devil. He asks, when launching a new project, do you think it's better to get it all out there ASAP or wait till you have everything 100%? The answer is you'll never have everything 100%. So what are you waiting for is kind of my take on it. You've got to get something out as soon as you can, that's good enough to roll with. You cannot
functional,
wait for perfection to happen, you know?
I agree. I mean,
ahead,
I just think it needs to be functional, and I think design's very important in this front. You want it to look right and good, but people get feature crazy and they never launch. I mean, it's like Gourmet Library, the site that I just launched. We sat on it way too long, mainly because I was stretched too thin, back to me being on too many things. But once I finally decided to narrow down the features, we got it out, and now we've already iterated, and there's been a bunch of features I would have waited for. So I think way too many people wait too long, and it kills them. We've seen that happen so much, Jace, right?
Oh, it happens to us, I mean, all the time, too. The thing is that But also, the advantage of launching early and not launching complete is that, let's say you want to do 10 things and you just do 5 of them, you're better off getting those 5 things out because the remaining 5 may or may not be important. And probably you'll find that most things aren't important that you thought that were, that you thought would be, and then there's new things that come out that are important that you never considered in the first place. And the only way you'll ever find that out is if you get something out there. So our saying around the office is, you're better off with half a product than a half-assed product. You know, you're better off kicking ass on half of it and getting it out than a half-ass hole that took you 2 extra years to get done. So that's my tip.
I like that. I like that a lot. Sean DMD says, what process do you use to determine if an idea is worth pursuing? Sean, for me, it comes down to if the idea lingers. For example, a lot of you guys might have saw Cinderella Wine. And it's not a new idea. It's very much, you know, Woot.com. But it kept lingering and lingering. Like, I need to get into space. I have the backbone of Wine Library to do it better than anybody. I know wine better than anybody who's doing it. And so then I finally did it. And it sat for like 6 months. I have an idea a day. I told AJ 6 different business ideas today. If one of them sits around long enough, if it sits in my craw for 6 months to a year, then I'll do it. I mean, very rarely is there an idea that's so powerful to me that I do it right on the spot. Jason?
That's actually pretty interesting. I'd never thought of it that way, but I think you're right. The things that keep coming back over and over and over are the things you ought to do, because you will have ideas all the time. And it's one way to get scattered if you just keep pursuing every new idea. But, you know, I like patience. And, Gary, we've talked about this, is you got to be patient. And one way to use patience to your advantage is to wait out an idea a little bit and see if you're really excited about it next week. And you're really excited about it 3 weeks later, maybe 2 months later. Then you know that you're into it. Because there's so many things you could be excited about for 2 days, and then a week later you're not into it anymore. But if something is...
That happens to me all the time.
2 months later, you got to do it. Yeah, totally. Totally does. So that's great advice. I'm on board with that one for sure.
Cool, man. Go ahead.
All right. Let's see. Okay, Robert. When you're starting from zero, how do you build an audience? So I hear this a lot. People say, you know, well, you guys are lucky. You've got all these readers, and Gary's lucky because he's got 100,000 people watching his wine. But it didn't start that way, so it was zero. And the answer is, I mean, Gary kind of rocketed up there. It took me a lot longer to sort of get where we are. We've been doing this for 10 years, the weblog. But you've got to just be patient. You've got to put out good content. You've got to really focus on it and do a good job. And just, you know, obviously you've got to get the word out. That's something you're going to have to do. And some people are better at it than others. But it's still going to take time. You cannot think that you're just going to grow this huge audience immediately. So just get in there, do good content, keep doing it. Get the word out. Tell people who you think might share it with others. Just keep doing good stuff. People will notice you. You cannot go unnoticed today if you're good. I just don't think you can do that anymore. Before, maybe you would never be noticed. Today, everyone can be discovered and probably will be if they're any good.
I think that's an interesting point. I do agree that it's very hard to go unnoticed. I would say this. Recognize that you are in a time in the world now where it's easier for you to get recognized with zero than it was for Jason and I. Because word of mouth is what builds anything. And word of mouth has been activated. And that's where it gets interesting. Twitter and Facebook have changed the game dramatically. Because I had to get noticed by going to forums, Jace, and going to other blogs and leaving comments and just becoming part of the community. The way to get noticed is to go to the cocktail parties. It's kind of like how to get noticed in high school. Believe it or not, you know, if you just went to every party, if you were invited or not, you'd get noticed, right? And that's kind of what it is. You got to swim where the fish are. And so I agree with Jace. Quality of content is the only thing. For example, a great-looking dude that goes to every party is going to have better results than an ugly dude in high school. It's very simple. You know, his content was better. So, but it's very funny. If you pay attention, a lot of dudes senior year, second semester, a lot of the nerds end up hooking up with pretty girls because they've worked it systematically. And so I think it's just hard work. The reason I think I skyrocketed up, Jace, in a lot of ways was my content was good and different, but I was really putting in 18 hours a day every day, which is an ungodly amount. And it was differentiated. You know, it's always the same game. Is your content differentiated, and is it good enough, and does it serve a purpose? And so I was early to market with video a little bit. So I think if you've got good stuff, that you will get noticed. I agree with you. I like that statement. You should do something about that, Jace, saying how it's impossible to not
get noticed. I'm going
to
write something about that.
I agree.
Yeah, I'll write something on that. You know, the other thing, Gary, that I think is interesting about the way you did it was that not only was your content good, but it was consistent and regular. And that's something that's so hard to do. A friend of mine, actually, I go to a trainer, you know, to work out 3 days a week. And I told him, like, you got to start a video blog, man. You are badass at this. You're really good. You're personable. You're good on camera. You got to do this. And he did it for like a week and then just kind of gave up. And that's not going to work. That's not going to work for you. But, Gary, you were doing it every single day when no one was watching, putting out great content every day, and you have to make that sort of commitment if you want to make something happen. So you can't do it for a week and go, man, no one noticed me. I'm out of here. You really just got to keep doing it, like, kind of for the love of the game, basically, at the end of the day. So anyway.
And the love of the process is the whole game. In my opinion, the love of the process is the only option now, because it's going to take so hard to have the patience to be noticed that if you don't have love for the game, you've lost.
Yep, agreed.
All right. Kaiser Sue says, which generally draws a larger audience, goes more viral, video or podcast? Is podcast audio? Is that what you mean, Kaiser Sue? Do you mean audio versus video? I just want to get that. Yes. You know, Jace, do you feel the same way about this, whether it's audio, video, or written word? It comes down to the content. I mean, TechCrunch and Mashable, and you're crushing it on written word, and I'm crushing it on video. You've got to find the platform that's best for you, and it's simple as that. I don't think one has an advantage over the other, believe it or not. I really don't.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the good lesson there is you got to do what you're good at, and you're great at video, so you do video. Other people want to be great at writing.
Right.
I do think, though, fundamentally, We're a species that likes to watch other people's faces move. So I do think that video has that. It's in terms of viralness, whatever, video is, it's a passive thing. You can sit back and watch. It doesn't take a lot of effort to watch and be part of it. So I think that has an advantage. But if you're going to put yourself at a disadvantage because you're not comfortable in front of the camera, you're much better off behind a microphone. You know?
I think that's a very good point. By the way, guys, here's a big one for you. I let blogging go by. Watching Jason and Anil Dash and you know, Jason Kotke and Waxy.org, watching all these people blog 03, 04, 05 was tough for me, but it wasn't a medium that I thought I was good at. I didn't even enter the game. I mean, think about that patience.
Yeah. But that's a good lesson because you don't need to be first at this stuff either. I don't think you really do. Now, you might have a different opinion about that, like especially nowadays. Do you have a different take on that, or whether or not you need to be first?
I think you can be 900,000. If you're the best, you're the best. It's kind of like
that's right.
It's kind of like if you move into town. I love high school analogies because people understand them. It's like if the prettiest girl moves into town halfway through the school year, she's still going to be the hottest girl in school.
Yep.
So, that's kind of how it's. Go ahead, Jason.
All right. Let's see. What do you think, Survive 2-5, which is actually a good name. I like that. What do you think holds people back from being self-employed? What would you advise they do to get over it? I think a big part of it, I mean, people obviously have different, there are people in different stages of their lives. Some people can't quit their job and they just can't do it and the whole thing, and I get that. But as far as younger people go, which is probably most of the people in this audience, I'm guessing, you know, I think people are afraid of the risk and they're afraid of quitting their day job and not having a safety net and the whole thing. And I think Gary and I both agree on this one that you really shouldn't be quitting your day job. You should start something on the side and see what happens. And that gets rid of that whole risk thing, this whole risk equation, like, fuck, I don't have any money. I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm screwed. And then you start getting nervous and stressed out and you don't perform very well. But if you kind of try something at night, a few hours a night, a few hours a week, whatever it is to get started, you've got a good shot at building something that's good. And seeing what happens and not, you know, fucking up your future if it doesn't work. So that's my take on it.
I totally agree with that. I mean, nobody, for a guy that's so rah-rah like me, nobody's more practical. I don't want any, I mean, every time I get an email, I got three today, and they're titled, I quit my job, I'm always like, no, you know, I get scared.
Right. Yeah.
That is not what's interesting to me. Practicality, paying your mortgage, and you're right. pay attention to a quarterback when he gets blitzed. He doesn't perform as well. Quitting your job does that for you, because all of a sudden the pressure starts squeaking in. Everything is best when it's on the side, until you can afford to leave whatever you're doing and make that full time. I very much agree with you on that. Completely. All right. Let's see. Okay, ID35, do you guys outsource any part of your personal lives, a la Tim Ferriss? How about in your business, not just hiring contractors, but full-time international outsourcing? I think you guys probably know this about me. I'm like the total anti-outsourcer to a point that probably makes Jason, who's smarter, vomit. I answer all my email, all my tweets. I outsource things I don't like to do. Scheduling, you know, I outsource. Listen, I don't run day-to-day operations for Wine Library as much as I used to. I'm outsourcing a $65 million thing, a business kind of thing. But my personal brand is me, and I don't outsource that. I don't know how you can. And I really think that people are overlooking the big thing. Not only are you doing the right thing and making people happy, but, Jason, here's a big thing. I think my pulse of the market is so fierce because I do my own research and development. I'm tasting it via my inbox and my tweets and my Facebook wall messages every day.
Yeah, you know, when we first launched Basecamp in 2004, which is a fucking fortune, a long time ago, for the first 3 years, I did all the customer service. So I did all the email support. I responded to every email we got. And that was incredibly valuable. And the easy thing to do is to say, no, I'll just outsource that to somebody else or hire someone for it because I don't want to bother with it. But you will learn more from that than anything you'll ever do in your life, I think. When you're actually responding to the people who are buying your products, hearing their problems, getting frustrated by their problems because they're bothering you with them, then like the power that that gives you to make change and to make them happy is extraordinary. And you'll never get that from someone else telling you what the problems are. You'll only get that from someone who bought your product telling you directly what the problems are. So I would never outsource stuff like that. But I'm with Gary. I don't do everything that I do that we do. I mean, I don't do the accounting. I used to, actually, and we outsourced that recently. We do sometimes hire programmers that we don't employ full time. We just hired somebody to do the new Haystack site we launched. We hired someone from London actually to do that with us. So we'll do some of that stuff. But as far as like core, super important things, I think you got to do that stuff yourself. It's the only way you'll really get to understand it too. One other thing, actually, if I may, on that, this has a lot to do with who you hire, too. I'm a big believer that you've got to try and do the job yourself before you hire someone to do it. So, like, a year or so ago, we were thinking to ourselves, we should hire a biz dev guy. And I didn't even know why, but you just feel like, oh, we need a biz dev guy. Everyone has a biz dev guy. We went out and interviewed a bunch of biz dev guys, and I didn't know what I was asking them. I didn't know if their answers were any good. I didn't know if they were going to be any good because I'd never done the job myself. I couldn't actually decide whether or not their answers were good and their skills were good because I had nothing to compare it to. So I feel like you've got to do that first before you can actually bring someone on to do the job.
You know what? That's so funny you said that. I never hired anybody in my life that has ever done a job that I not done except the developer. And I don't know how you could, because boy oh boy, when you've lived it and you've touched it, you know exactly if the answers are right or not.
That's it. It's the only way you'll ever know.
Yep. I think it's your turn to ask a question, right? Or mine?
Oh. I don't know, actually. I'll take it, though.
Go ahead.
Let's see. I'm looking for something here. Let's see. All right, I'll skip on that one. Did you see something, Gary? I'm not finding anything right now.
What's that, bud? You want me to do it?
Do you see something? Yeah, why don't you take this one here? I'm going to look for another one that's...
Okay, CoderPath says, I'm just looking at the first one I see. I've been trying and failing at it for many years. How do you deal with fear? What tips do you have to shake off failure and keep swinging? CoderPath, let me tell you something really interesting about me. If I decide to do something, I've already won before I've started the process. See, I'm not in it to build the biggest business, or I'm not in it to buy a boat. I'm in it because I decided that that process was valuable to me in learning. And so I've won because I was into it for the process, not the results. And I think that's massively important to think about, because when I started Wine Library TV, I was confident it was going to be huge. Really, I was, from day one. But there was a part of me that said, well, what if it isn't? Well, I was going to learn about video on the internet, and I was going to live it 18 hours a day, and thus I was going to win because I was going to know something. So I truly believe that people make a mistake. They think they want stuff, millions of dollars, boats, cars. I promise you, if you go into things because you want to understand the process, you win every time. And I truly feel like I've never failed for that reason.
That's cool. I'm kind of the same way when it comes to that. I don't ever get involved with something that I don't think is going to work anyway, to begin with. And that comes down to just being selective, I think, and really believing in the things you're going to do. But even if it doesn't work for whatever reason or doesn't work as well, you learn something so important about it that it's kind of like, I don't really consider anything I've done to be a failure. And I know people think that that's a cocky statement, but I don't really mean it that way at all. I've gotten something important out of everything I've tried. And as long as I can, you know, feed myself and have a roof over my head, like, there's no big failure there. It's just experiences. And that's kind of the way I look at
it. Jason, I launched WineLibrary.com in 1997. I understood retail online like nobody's business. I can tell you right now, you guys, you 30 of you, and Jason, the 31 of you, you want to take something big away? I'll tell you right now, in the way that most people judge things, I would say that Wine Library and WineLibrary.com was a failure.
Right.
I'm going to tell you why. Because I promise, because if I was allowed to ship wine everywhere I could, I truly believe in my heart and soul with every ounce of it that Amazon and Zappos would have a third competitor, and that person's name would be Gary Vaynerchuk. But because I had to go into a family business, which was impossibly difficult, you've got to deal with all the family dynamics, and because of the liquor laws, which I knew I was going into because of that, I can tell you right now, I would say that the way people categorize things, that it was a failure. And that's pretty intense to say a $60 million business is a failure. But those were my best years, Jace. That was no Lizzie, no Misha, head down 18 hours a day, didn't have to worry about anything and anybody. That there was that special 22, 24, 26-year-old glow, you know?
Absolutely.
And,
yeah, I've been there too. That's a great feeling when you have that.
And I just really, really want people to understand that. I mean, I swear to you guys, and you can take this for whatever you want, I knew going into Wine Library I wasn't going to be winning. I used to cry going into my family's business. And even though everybody thinks I'm this big, big, you know, Jace, I see the $4 to $60 million thing flash up when I do all these interviews on TV, and everybody's like, wow, so impressed. When I talk, I see people's eyes. And all I say is, you guys have no fucking idea who I am. If this was something else, if we were selling food, if my dad had a little food store, I'd be a billionaire right now. I'd own the fucking Jets now. So, you know, but I did it because there was other things in play. I got to know my dad. Without it, I don't know him. I massively helped my family. Massively. My best friend works for the store. My other friends work for the store. My second cousin, my brother-in-law. It was a global give back. And so I just really hope people, you know, I haven't shared that thought. And it's, and so, you know, I don't know how everybody just took that, but it's a very powerful thing and a very close thing to me. And I hope people understand it's not about the dollars and cents. It's about what you're getting out of it.
And I think related to that is this idea that people who think they fail typically think they fail in other people's eyes. Like, they let someone else define what success is for them. And that's, you know, for example, someone could look at 37 Signals and go, you guys should be worth $10 billion by now. You know, what the fuck? And I don't care what they think we should be worth. Like, we're very successful on our own terms. And that's all that really matters. So you don't have to say, like, I want to make X to be successful, or I want to have X to be successful. It's really not about that. It's about, you know, what makes you really happy? Why are you really doing this? Can you go to work every day and enjoy it for the most part? And that's really what it's all about. Now, you can also have a ton of money and make a ton of money doing this sort of thing, you know, but don't let someone else define what success means to you. Don't look at another company or a competitor and go, I'm not as successful as them, so I failed. They beat me. That's not how it has to be. You don't have to think about things that way.
Yeah, I agree. Listen, at the end of the day, it's very simple. Let me bang out a couple quick questions, Jace. Do you think your family business was a big leg up in terms of your career, Rob Murray? I definitely do. I mean, there's no denying that all the hard work and sweat my dad put in gave me a big leg up. It gave me a big starting point leg up, but I think, you know, at the same token, there was a lot of things that kept me back. The laws of the liquor industry and the fact that I wasn't a family business where I had to appease my dad's feelings. So that's for sure. I just think that that's it. And then you know, somebody else said, would you switch places in terms of running businesses with each other? Well, that's a good question. You start with that, Fried.
Wow. That is good. I don't think I could do what you do. So, I mean, but it'd be I do love retail. I got to say, I love retail. I would love to own a store. For the longest time, or run a store. For the longest time, I've wanted to have a tea shop. Just so I can sell products to people in person. I love, and I have huge respect and envy for your position there. But I don't think I could do like a video show every day. I don't think I could be all over the globe like you are all the time. But I would love to run retail for a while. I would have a blast doing that.
My respect for Fried is very high because I feel like as I mature and get older, some of the things that Fried believes in become more of my principles. And to me, that means he's just ahead of me in a lot of ways. I'm really bad at not being me. And so I don't think I'm capable of really being anybody but me. Because I'm, you know, I think it's very, listen, there's a lot of characters in this game, right? Right now, I think it's very obvious to most people that there's not a whole lot that look just like me. So
yes.
I've got a different kind of spice, you know? And I don't know if that's good or bad.
Here's the cool thing about that. Here's the cool thing about that. You know, people sometimes I think will look at you and they'll think like, man, I can't be as successful as Gary because I don't have the personality or I'm not as outgoing and the whole thing, you know? Like I'm many ways the opposite. I'm an introvert, I'm quiet, I like to be at home most of the time. So the cool thing I think about it is that it doesn't really matter what your personality type is. It doesn't really matter if you're outgoing or not outgoing or you want to stay home or you want to go out. It doesn't really matter. And that's I think the best lesson is that you don't have to be like someone else, and Gary, you talk about this all the time. Don't be like me. Don't try and run the next Wine Library TV for baseball. You know, don't be like me. Be yourself, and that's really what matters. And so you don't have to fit into a certain mold to be an entrepreneur or to be a successful business person, to be outgoing and the whole thing. You don't have to be that way. And that's cool. That's what I think is really cool about this call, is that we have technically two very different kinds of people who are both successful in their own businesses, but run them completely differently and have very different personalities. And I think that's awesome. Very, very cool to see.
I agree. And let me say one thing from you guys. I'll tell you right now, Jason and I are very different, but boy, oh boy, you can see we've answered a lot of questions similarly. And there's one thing we really are the same about, which is we really think we're the best. I mean, there's one thing I connect with Fried on that's different than, you know, K. Rose or some of the other people I connect with very heavily. You and I, where we really, really cross paths, is that we truly think we're the fucking best. Our self-esteem is off the charts, and it's a very substantial backbone of us both winning. I firmly believe that.
Yeah, actually, I think we do have a lot in common as well, but I agree with you on that point. You have to truly, you got to believe you're good at what you do. You can't be afraid of it, and I think, especially on the internet, there's a lot of people who are afraid of money. I don't understand that at all. Like, people are afraid to charge for things. They're afraid that, you know, people are going to say no if they ask them for a price or whatever. You've got to have the confidence in your product, in yourself, to say, this is worth something, and I'm going to charge you for it. And I think that that's sort of where you see people's self-esteem break down, is they don't feel like they're good enough to ask people for money. And I think if you're going to be successful at business, you better get used to asking people for money, because that's the only thing that's going to keep you going. I mean, not the money, like the goal of money, but you know, you got to pay the bills, you got to employ people, you got to give people a good environment to work in, all those sorts of things. So you got to get used to charging for things.
I agree.
So right, I found something I wanted to hit on real quick, a quick one. Someone asked me where I get matcha tea online, the Shane 100. I get it from a couple different places. Try matcha, M-A-T-C-H-A, source.com. And also Harney and Sons. I think they're out in New York or New Jersey. Harney.com, H-A-R-N-E-Y.com. Actually, I'll type those in the chat so you guys have them.
Nice. Go ahead.
Why don't you take a question while I'm typing this stuff up? Go ahead.
All right, let's see what we got. What do you look for in a partner co-founder, and when you find them, how do you get them on board? Casey, this is massively interesting. I think I'm very close to deciding on my next book, and I think I'm going to call it Tag Team Champions. And it's going to be the breakdown of how I feel there's only two people that you need to build a big-ass business, and that's the person that knows how to story tell and sell, and the person that knows how to create content, because I've met a lot of people on this tour that can pump out such amazing content. Nobody knows more about fly fishing in the world than they do, but they couldn't sell a guy starving a 99-cent, you know, feast. And on the flip side, I've seen so many slicksters, guys that just can sell their ass, but the spammy bullshit, horseshit, landing page, affiliate, selling vitamin horseshit crap that these guys push, they have no content skills. And I think if you can combine the two, there can be something really special. I think the perfect partner is, you know, the person that, you know, molds into you. There's no one fit. You know, there's that person, you know, sometimes it's somebody who can be a number two to your number one or vice versa. Somebody that brings different skill sets. And I'm really trying to break this out in my mind right now. It's actually the book I'm thinking about writing, Jason.
Yeah, I like that book. That's a pretty good book, because that's a question I get all the time, too, about should you have a co-founder, you know, how many people should you have? When I started 37 Signals, there were actually three partners, myself and two other guys. One of them left about a year, and the other one left a few years, and then it was back to me for a while, for about 4 years. Then I brought on David Hansen as a partner in the company. And so I've been all over the board. I've started something myself. I've worked with three other partners, with two partners, back to myself, the whole thing. And essentially, my dad always told me never go into business with a partner. He was always, and still probably believes, that like, you're best off doing something yourself. And so I've taken that advice at some time in my life, but I'm super happy with David as a partner, because David sort of, this is the cheesy Jerry Maguire thing, but he sort of completes me in terms of, like, I'm not a programmer. He's a programmer. So I needed someone who was totally had a completely different skill set than I do. I'm a designer, and I know the business stuff, and David's a programmer, he knows the business stuff. So we lock up together on the business stuff, but, like, we see eye to eye on the business stuff, but on the design stuff, I take care of that, and on the programming stuff, David takes care of that. So I actually think what's important here is that you don't just want to have two people with totally different skill sets. You want to have two people with different skill sets, but also with one shared skill set, because that's kind of what hooks you together on big decisions. And I think that us, business is that thing that David and I see eye to eye on, but programming and design are two things that we do differently.
Yeah, you know, I'm funny. I mean, I don't think I could have a partner that's not a family member, and that's because I'm really not good collaborative. I'm very czar-like. I'm really crazy. I just always think I'm right and I'm the best, and I don't even know how to do it any other way. I'm not kidding. And ironically, that's where I'm a huge contradiction. On the flip side, I read every comment that's negative about me, and I respect it and understand it and agree with it. It's just I'm not capable. I'm just not capable. This is what made me a shit student. I'm not capable. Reed, I can't be in a cage, man. I'm like a wild beast. I just, you know,
yeah.
I'm just not good with that.
Sometimes. Yeah, it's tough for me. I'm sure it's tough for David sometimes. We want to do, you know, we want to do our own thing on certain things. But you just got to find the right co-partner, right? I don't think you're capable of it. I don't think that you could do it. You know, I don't think that's bad or anything. It's just like you are definitely your own guy. You are definitely the leader of your own pack, and that's just the way it is. So I think you can be either or. You can be that way, or you can find a co-partner or founder or whatever. But you've got to find, if you're going to work with someone else, it's so important that you guys get along and see things eye to eye. It's so important, because you're going to be miserable if you don't, just terribly miserable. You're not going to make good decisions. You're going to be stressed out. You're always going to be butting heads, and that just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. It's not worth it. So,
I agree, man. All right, your turn to ask look at a question.
Yeah, let me jump on one of these here. I saw one up here I highlighted. What made you look globally versus local for 37 Signals team? And Gary, you might actually jump in on this too. I don't know. You've got people all over the place too now, I think. But I'll tell you my story real quick. 37 Signals has 16 people, 8 of which are in Chicago, and then 8 of which are in 8 other cities around the world. We got people in states. We got people in Idaho. We got a guy in Idaho, Oklahoma, someone in Spain, a couple people in the Toronto area. And to me, what's important is working with the best people you can find, regardless of where they are.
I don't think geography matters that much anymore. Now, it's good to get together occasionally. It's good to see face-to-face occasionally. But I think if you can find the perfect match in Idaho, then you hire the guy in Idaho. And if you need to bring him to Chicago or New York or wherever you are, then you fly him in occasionally. But you want to find the best talent you can. There's no reason in my mind to have someone who's not as good as somebody else just because they're local. I just don't really find that to be the way to go. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to find the best talent. I'm talking about the best person-talent combination. And so, for example, Jameis, who's based in Idaho, is a great guy and a great programmer and the perfect fit for us. So he can stay in Idaho, and we can be in Chicago, and we get along just fine. So I don't think you should limit yourself. Now, Gary's lucky because Gary's in New York, where there's a ton of talent. And if you're on the West Coast, there's a ton of talent. But I know there's people like in Kansas City and Oklahoma City who say they can't find great talent, then you got to start looking elsewhere. But you can still stay in Oklahoma City, so you can still stay in Kansas City, but broaden your horizon and just find great talent, and you'll figure out ways to work together.
You know, I'm kind of funny on this. I really like people being around each other. And this is not that we disagree, but I guess it depends on... What's that?
I said we can disagree. Go ahead and disagree. It's totally cool.
Oh, listen, you know I'm not scared. You know, we agree on way more than we disagree. Here's where it's interesting for me. I am obsessed with culture and DNA. And I desperately want to taste the person. Maybe that's not the right way to put it. In Russian, that's how you say it, so I translated in my mind. I want to feel the person. I don't think I can hire somebody of major, major, major consequence without at least spending the first 6 months with them. I've got to sleep with them, as they say. It's big for me because I'm very good at kind of not instilling my thoughts, but definitely communicating my feelings and my energy. And in 3 months, I can tell you if somebody's going to work for me. Honestly, I can tell you in 3 minutes, but in the real life, in 3 months, I can tell you if I can work with somebody for the rest of my life, if they can travel for 9 months and then come back and do their thing, all that jazz. But I need those. I couldn't have somebody in Idaho for in the beginning. I would say, come work with me in New York for 6 months and then go wherever the hell you want. But I need that beginning time to really, really understand them. I need that.
Yeah, there's a lot that comes with that, you know, when you are around somebody for a long period of time, especially in the beginning. And whenever we hire someone, no matter where they live, we always bring them in. We meet them. We, you know, interview them locally. We hang out locally. Sometimes we'll test drive them for a month on a project to see if we can get along, if they can get along with us. So I do feel that, but... I mean, there's just different ways of looking at it, I guess. I totally hear where you're coming from. My feeling, though, in general, is that when people are too close, they tend to interrupt each other. And when you interrupt each other, you're not actually getting work done. There's a misconception that interruption equals collaboration, and I just don't buy that. I think that when people are around each other too much, it's so easy to just not do something and just talk about it. So I like bringing people together occasionally, and then sending them away so they can actually go get work done and then come back together and then go away and that sort of thing. So I'm a big fan of that. But, you know, whatever works for you is what matters. Obviously, your methods work for you and ours work for us. So whatever, everyone out there who's listening, just take whatever, you know, take 10% of my stuff and 10% of Gary's stuff and do your own stuff and see what happens.
Joe Hampus says, how do you know if you can work with a person in 3 minutes? What would your question be if you could only ask one? There's only one question I'm always curious to ask, and if they answer it, it's a huge factor for me. Everything else is really a la carte and different and blah, blah, blah. And that's, did you sell something before you were 8? Big, big question in my world, because it allows me to categorize you very easily, and it never fails. So that's my big one. Reed?
That's pretty interesting. I don't have one question, but I do tend to ask different questions. So, for example, if we're hiring a designer, I don't really care that much about the work after I know it's pretty good. I'll ask them something like, you know, they come in with a messenger bag. I'll say, why'd you buy that bag? And if someone goes, well, you know, it was the first bag I saw. I needed a bag real quick, so I bought it. That's not a very interesting answer to me. But if someone says, well, I bought it because I love the way the zipper works, and I love the way this flap is set up, and I love the cushioning on this thing, and I like how you can turn it inside out, and there's this pocket over here. I like people who are curious about stuff and who like look at things carefully to truly deeply understand that. People who are very observant
I think are really great hires, and those kind of people.
That's awesome.
I tend to ask questions like that are sort of abstract and off the topic about an object or something, some choice they've made, some decision they made, and I want to hear about why they made it. So it can be anything, but I want to hear about why they made it. Yep.
Preet, you would never hire me because I would buy the first fucking thing in the store for two reasons. Because I respect the game. I love that it was on display and they made me buy it. I love and respect the retail game, so they were pushing it.
Yep.
And number two, because I don't want to waste one fucking minute on a bag.
So bags are important to you then. But you waste time, I mean, not waste, but that, see, I
don't
think it's waste. That's the difference. I don't think that it's wasting time on a bag if you find that right bag that's good for you. Like, you.
No, I understand. I think that's brilliant. I'll tell you right now, I am the craziest shopper you've ever seen. I'm in and out like chow. I'm in and out like it's the first time you had sex. You know, like, I'm like so out, it's not even funny.
The thing is, you know, that's fine. That works for you. I'm generally more interested when I'm hiring somebody about like their thought process. And so if someone's kind of manic and they don't know why they're doing what they're doing necessarily, I'm not that interested in hiring that kind of person. Because they're not, like, especially when talking about designers, I want to know, like, what drives them about design. What is it about something that they like? What are the decisions that go into making that decision? So that's sort of where I'm coming from on this. But, like, when I go to the grocery store, I'm a quick shopper, too. I don't really look at things. There's 15 things of peanut butter on the shelf. I'll just take one of them that's closest to me. I don't care because, to me, it's all about the same thing. But when you're talking about something that's not about the same thing, like to me, like a bag or something like that, has a lot of variety in it. I'm just curious the decisions people made about those things. So that's my
I think that's really interesting. All right, Preet, your turn. I think I asked like two or three questions in a row.
All right. Let's see here. Okay, JF, how'd you guys manage time and family when doing extra projects when still working with clients and companies? So that's WebClick2006 who asked the question. When we built Basecamp, on the side, sort of like Gary and I were talking about earlier, building a business on the side is a good idea. We were a web design company. We were just doing web design work for hire. If Gary was around at the time, he would have hired us to do a website, and we do it, and we deliver it, and we move on to the next client. That's the business we were in. And we got busy with that business, and we needed a better way to manage our client projects. So we looked for client project management software, and we didn't like anything that we saw, so we decided to build something in our spare time on the side whenever we had time. We basically treated the development of a product as a client, so we can only throw 10% of our time at it because we had 10 other clients or whatever. And that's how we managed it. You know, we didn't set out to say we're going to build this big thing that's going to be successful. We just said we're going to build something that we need. We're going to do it in our spare time. When it's done, and we'll launch it. And that's sort of how we did it originally. And every side project we've worked on since then has always been treated as simply a side project. When we have extra time, when we have spare time, when maybe on the weekends you might want to do it, or maybe at night you want to stay an extra hour, whatever it is, that's how we build stuff on the side. So we're not really that obsessed with scheduling and planning, and I'm just not a big fan of that stuff. I'm a fan of finding the time to do it when you really want to do it because you really care about it.
I think that's brilliant, man. Yeah, I mean, it's so funny. VaynerMedia, we're about to go through the same thing, Preet. I mean, I'm building things now because I need them and because I understand what clients are doing, especially in the consumer brands products. Those suckers got a lot of money, you know? And I could see us going through the same damn thing because it's just a better business, you know?
That's right. No question.
Cool. All right, let's ask, here's hockey player. What do you do when people think you're cocky, but really you just talk with confidence, especially when you're younger than the one you're consulting for? I mean, I think both of us are going to be very good at answering this question. Hockey, let me tell you something right now. Anybody who's an A-plus player never thinks anybody's cocky. Preet, do you think anybody in the world's cocky?
Nope. Nobody.
Me neither. Not a person. Not Donald Trump, not Mark Cuban, not Bezos, not Jobs. I don't think a damn, not Calcanis, not Arrington, everybody, whatever level of success or hype or followers, I do not think one person in the world is cocky. And so why I am bringing this up is the biggest successes I've had in my life is because somebody else who was an A player in the room, when they saw my quote-unquote cockiness, they understood exactly what it was, which was fire and confidence, period. We can end the call now.
Yeah, I'm not even going to jump in on that question because I completely agree with that. And the other thing is you just can't really care. If people call you cocky or arrogant, you just can't care. You cannot let it get to you. Because the people who say that, they don't really understand what it takes. You have to have an enormous amount of confidence and belief in yourself and willingness to do what other people aren't doing, do it your own way. And the only way to do that is to appear cocky to other people who don't understand that. And that's just the bottom line.
Hey, guys, just a little breaking news. I'm sure people saw this. I guess Oprah's ending her show.
No shit.
Right? I guess I better be ready for 2011. Yeah. She's announced after her 25th season. That's crazy, huh?
That's a big blow for Chicago.
Yeah, I need to get on that before it's over.
Wow. I guess I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised by that, actually.
I'm not surprised either, you know?
25 trying to do something.
Something's going to have to fill that void, and I think there's a cocky little Russian boy that might want to do it. All right, let's answer some more questions. Gary, what's the worst advice you received early on Wine Library and on 37 Signals? That's a great, great question. Casey, the worst piece of advice I got was that in the retail business, there's three things. Three things. Service, selection, and price. And the only way to be really successful is to pick two. And I thought that was idiotic. The reason is they don't think there's enough margin in it if you do all three. And what I always said to myself was, why wouldn't I do all three? Because if I did all three, they'd have no reason to go anywhere else. So somebody very smart who ran a $100 million company told me that, and it was definitely the worst piece of advice, that if I didn't have the self-esteem and would have listened to him, I don't think I'd be where I am today.
Hmm. Yeah, in the software world, the worst advice we ever got was that, you know, features win, that you have to do more than your competition. And that's how software ends up turning into crappy software, is that there's basically a Cold War going on where everyone's trying to outdo each other on features. And for the first few years of a product, it's pretty good idea. But eventually, you just pile on and pile on and pile on, and things get too hard. So what we do is we basically underdo the competition, and we try and do less than everybody else and just have a really focused product and focused features and just products that do a few things well and then do nothing else. Basically, the idea is focus on the basics. And in the software business, it's really about bells and whistles. It's really about more, 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 and that's just people always tell us, they continue to tell us this today, that we're fucked when this other company comes out which has more features and we're fucked this and fucked that. Meanwhile, we continue to grow, we continue to do really well, and our customers really want basic, simple products that just do a really good job at what they do. So I think a big lesson in general is that you don't have to do more than anybody else to succeed. You just have to do those things better. Whatever you're doing, just do those things better. And no, very, very few companies are focused on the basics. I think the basics are the best things you can be focused on. When you go to a hotel, you don't give a shit about the flat screen TV and the fancy, you know, lobby if your bed's uncomfortable. You know, you got to get the bed right. And when you know, this is why people love Southwest Airlines. Southwest Airlines is usually on time, first of all. The planes aren't the most comfortable, they're not the cleanest, they're not the most modern, but they're on time and the price is right. That's the basics. It's not about the in-flight entertainment, it's about, are you going to get where you want to go on time and are the prices fair? And so I think whenever companies lose sight of the basics, they're just going to die. They're going to die eventually because someone's going to outdo them on the things that really matter, and that's the basics. So always stay focused on those things.
I think that's a really good answer. I really hope for the people in this room. Guys, I really hope you like that. I'm going to say that's pretty funny because that reminds me so much of what I call the Mariano Rivera rule. The guy's got one pitch. You can say anything you want, baseball fans. Guy's got one pitch. And Fried, nobody can hit it.
Yep. That's it.
Nobody can hit it.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. It's so critical, I think, to just have that. Yeah, have that one pitch or those three pitches, whatever it is. And in that case, it's one. But, like, you know, if you're a business, it might be five things you do really well or three things you do really well. But just make those things so damn good that no one else is going to dare challenge you on them. They're going to have to go upstream. They're going to have to add more and more and more bells and whistles to try and convince you because they can't nail the basics. So I really think the basics are the secret weapon. I really do, especially today, where everything is, like, so complicated. More and more and more shit on everything. You know, focus on the basics. Go the other direction. That's a great way to win these days, I think.
Well, listen, that's why Twitter won in a lot of ways, don't you think?
Totally. I mean, Twitter's a fucking text box, and that's it. And that's why it's so damn easy and so damn successful, because you can't know how to use it. You know, you can't fuck up. You can't make a mistake, even. Is it maybe the only software in the world that you can't make a mistake using? That's huge. And I think that sort of thing is just so underrated still. The basics are so underrated. Gary thinks the internet's still underrated. I think basics are still underrated. And they will be forever, because it's hard for people to be disciplined enough to stop there. They always want more, Reed, more, 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 you know?
Reed, the internet is underrated. The modern consumer internet is 15 years old.
I know, it's amazing. So young.
It's a fucking amazing! It's 15, Reed! It's 15! I mean, that blows my face off. Look what we're doing right now. We're talking on a phone. People are in AIM chat box. I mean, it's crazy. It's 15. It is the most underrated thing in our society, period. CoderPath says, is there anything you obsess over? Just the health of my family. I obsess over the health of my family. I think about it every day, which is unhealthy. Reed?
Truthfully, and I don't mean to kiss ass, but that is the thing I respect most about you, actually, is your focus on that. You always bring that up. And I think as long as you have sight of that and keep that in sight, you're going to be fine no matter what you do in life. As long as you get those basics.
Whether you
right,
win or lose.
Fine.
You're right. You're right. Well, thanks, man. How about you? What are you obsessed about?
I sort of obsess about writing, actually. I don't like obsessing, actually, about things, but I tend to do it more than I'd like to. But for me, like, I get the most joy these days out of writing the perfect sentence. So I love taking a sentence that's 24 words long and making it 18, then making it 16, then making it 10, then making it 7, then making it 3. Like, I love that process of editing. And to me, that's really what I'm pumped about these days and what I really obsess over, especially on in our products and our website. And
you know what's so funny? That's actually a lot of my success. Several very big-time media types have come up to me recently and said, do you know why you win? And I'm like, because I'm so handsome. They're like, no. They're like, you don't process. There's very few people we've seen in the, you know, they're like, there's not a lot of people that process the way you do. You only process tight. You're a soundbite. And that's why people can consume you. And so I'm not good enough to write that pretty 24-word sentence. My ability is only to be a 7-word sentence, you know?
Yes.
And not that that's good or bad. I mean, I wish I had the other part.
I think it's good. I think it's good in every way. I think the other most underrated thing today, besides the internet and besides the basics, is clarity. Clarity, people talk about simplicity, and they talk about usability, and they talk about all these things. Clarity is the most important thing, I think, out there today. And Gary, you're very clear. Your statements are very clear. Your point of view is very clear. You know, everyone knows where you stand. That is so valuable. It's so valuable for politicians, for anybody who has a point of view. If it's clear, you get it. You don't have to think about it. You know where someone stands. And that is so underrated. So I'm pretty obsessed with clarity these days. That's the big thing.
You know what's so funny? It's why I lose in poker. I'm such an all-in motherfucker. I'm just all in. I'm all in. okay, go ahead. You.
Oh, yeah, my question. My bad. Sorry. Let's see here. I already did that one. Well, here's something related, I guess.
Wait a minute. Do that one.
Yeah. You talk a lot about being less. When is less too much? How do you know if a feature adds usability or it's just flash? My take is this. I try and boil down everything into one point here. Is something useful? If it's useful, it's worth it. So there's a lot of focus on innovation. You hear people try saying, I want to be innovative. I want to do the next big thing, or I want to be innovative. I don't really care about innovation at all. I care about usefulness. It's something useful. That's what people want. I promise everybody here who's listening on the phone today, you will be using Post-it notes in 20 years. I promise you, you'll be using Post-it notes in 20 years. You may not be using this technology or that technology. You'll be using Post-it notes because they're fucking useful. And to me, if it's useful, it's worth doing.
I think that's a great, great answer. I just want to tell everybody what I'm doing right now. I had to, you're going to love this. I had to go to GoDaddy, and I'm trying to register Oprah September 9, 2011.com.
Did you get it?
I don't know. I'm trying to get it right now. Yep, Oprah September 9, 2011.com is available. I'm going to let it go. I'm not going to take it, but that's the last day of her show. Anyways, God, I still want to buy it. Okay. See. Thoughts on VC funding versus building something by yourself slowly, referring to online businesses. Think Corked, but another niche. Hockey player, don't take money. They're going to own you. You're not. VCs are not a good game for 99% of the people out there. Maybe a couple angel investors. I'll tell you right now, money in the bank. I'd rather get $50,000 from Jason Fried and have access to him for 1 hour four times a year than get $1 million from a faceless VC firm. Period. End of story.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, people who know me know I'm not a fan of venture capital. Let me tell you the basic reason why. When you're starting a business, you got to worry about money, okay? And there's two ways you can look at money. If you're a bootstrapped business, if you're starting a business yourself, self-funded, on day one, you're worried about making money. If you're a VC-funded company, you're worried about spending money. That's a huge,
right,
massive difference between the two sides. When you have $1 million in the bank from a VC, the first thing you do is you spend money. That's the wrong instinct to begin building up. That's the wrong habit. You want to get in the habit of having to make money, and that's why I love bootstrap companies, because you're forced to make money, and that's the best lesson you'll ever get in business.
I love it. I agree. Next question.
Your turn on that one, Gary.
My turn. How do you not freak out over competition while you're bootstrapping? Easily. Because competition will never put you out of business. Thank you.
That's related to a question I saw earlier, which I wanted to answer, which is, you know, when do you worry about the competition, the whole thing? You know, I'm aware of the competition, but I do not look at the competition. I do not think about the competition. You can't do that. When you start doing that, you're going to think you're just going to end up following. You're going to end up doing what they're doing, just slightly differently. And that's not the way to, first of all, enjoy what you're doing. And it's not the way to win either. I mean, you can't do what everyone else is doing. You're just going to be in second place or whatever. It doesn't even matter. Actually, let me take that back, because I don't care about second place or third place or first place. It doesn't even matter. It's like, are you doing your thing, or are you doing someone else's thing? You don't want to do someone else's thing. You want to do your thing. So don't pay attention to the competition. It just stresses you out. And that's the big thing that I don't like about when people are focused on the competition. They're focused on stress. They're always worried, what's that guy doing?
I'm so freaking weird on this. I don't give a fuck about what anybody else is doing. My dad is so the other way. He was always worried about, what's this store going to do? What's that store going to do? I'm like, Dad, my job in life is to make every wine store in America always worry about what I'm going to do, and then we've won. I said, I'm going to put everybody into such a sleeper hold, you know, like a cobra clutch, Sergeant Slaughter style, that they're just going to always spend all their time worrying about me while I'm worried about running our business. And I proved it to him that that was the way to go. I mean, I just don't even know what anybody else is doing. I have no idea what everybody else is doing.
Wait a minute, I'm going to cut here right now. Yeah.
Cameron Roke says, well, the competition stresses me out when they take my potential customer. That's not the right way, dude. Cameron, I'm telling you. It's just not, dude. Like, it doesn't matter if they take a potential customer. If you focus on your shit, you'll take that customer back. Spending a moment, even a second, on your competition, that's the Mike Tyson game, boys. That's why he won. You were so worried about him. You got to worry about yourself, man. It's just as simple as that. That is crystal clear to me. Crystal.
Yeah, I totally agree with you on that completely. I think it's one of the biggest misconceptions that especially new entrepreneurs have. I hear it whenever I speak at universities. I've been speaking to a lot of students lately, or speaking with them, actually. I do a lot of Q&A with them, too. And they always ask about the competition. Go ahead, Gary.
I'm sorry. Do you think the audience believes you've sold out if you advertise? Oh, okay. Is that Survivor? Is that... You're not saying my blog. You're saying, do people think... Fried, I want you to answer this one. Do you think an audience believes you sold out if you advertise on your blog?
What do you mean, like take ads? Is that what people are asking?
No, like if you get ads on your blog, it's sold out.
No, of course not. Do you think they? I'm not sure. I totally understand the question. Do you think if
that's the question?
Ads on your blog, have you sold out? No.
Me neither. And somebody asks, why don't I take ads?
Let me say this. A big part of that, though, is you can sell out by taking ads if it changes your point of view and your you know what you're writing about. So if you take ads from a company and you start praising that company because they're paying you, that's a fucking sellout. But if you just take ads to pay the bills and you're completely objective, that's not selling out at all. That's just being a good business.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and then Quick Ryan says banner ads aren't going to make you millions on your blog. Well, they can, Ryan. You know, Click Ryan. A lot of people don't recognize. Most people don't have the eyeballs to convert millions, but it can be there. And don't forget, money is coming. The amount of money that's going into this space that is going out of magazines and radio and television is going to be staggering. Staggering.
Is it, so are you seeing that with your clients, your Vaynermedia clients right now? Not putting money into newspapers and TV and all that kind of stuff?
Yes. You know why? Because jerk-offs like me are convincing them to do it, and then we test something for a couple G's, and they lose their mind.
Right.
Because I don't want them to buy banner ads like all the other digital agencies they work with. Nobody looks to the left and right. I mean, this is the first time I even noticed there was a Netflix ad in this chat room. We were just talking about this, and I looked just to see if there was anything on the right side. I didn't even notice there was a Netflix ad in this at all. People are not creative. I promise you, when we started up for this, if there was a Netflix bring down, up down, yeah, I guess people are having different ads on the right side. Somebody has Duracell. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that people are just not creative, Fried. Creativity is the game. And
that's true. A lot of people just doing the same old shit.
And so we're trying to be creative. Like, you know, like, could you imagine when the new Kindle came out, if Bezos sat for an hour and talked Q&A, and it was a takeover page on Mashable and TechCrunch and all these sites, you know how big that would be? And it would cost him less than if Amazon bought TV or radio ads. I mean, people just have to be creative. And I pride myself in creativity, and that's what we're doing for our clients, and that's why it's working.
I think you just sold out, Gary, right there. You just sold out, man.
I feel like I did.
All right, this guy Casey keeps asking me, how do you overcome your introvertedness to do your job? I don't think you have to overcome it. I mean, first of all, I just don't like being social all the time. And that's the difference, I think. An introvert is someone who really enjoys being by themselves, enjoys, you know, being quiet and having peace and quiet. But it doesn't mean that they're unable to, you know, engage people. You know, I'm fine with that. But I just don't like to do it all the time. That's all.
I, the other hand, will stick a gun in my mouth if I'm in a room by myself for 5 minutes. Tom Cop says, would you prefer running Apple or Microsoft these days? Not even close. For me, it would be Microsoft. Because I would want to come from not the hot place and win. You know, I'm so into the underdog. For me, it's all about the climb. It's why I don't like the Yankees anymore. They won, and I was out. That's why the Jets are a perfect team for me. How about you, Fried?
I completely agree. First of all, Apple is, I think, the best-run company on the planet, so I would only fucking fuck that up. I would screw that company up, I'm sure. Microsoft would be fascinating to run because they have, I mean, forget the money they have, but they have, like, a ton of brains. They're very, very smart. Although sometimes it doesn't look like it, they've got great people over there. They've got a great huge market share. They've got so much potential, yet they're kind of irrelevant right now. And it'd be a blast, I think, to bring that company back to relevance. I think it'd be fascinating. And I think it's totally possible, but they have to totally change what they're doing. But it'd be fun to do that. It's no fun to manage Apple. Apple's just badass. I mean, what are you going to do with Apple? But Microsoft, there's so much you can do right now. It'd be a real blast to do that.
You know what's so funny? The company that I'm obsessed with is Yahoo. I would love to run Yahoo.
Yeah.
Because Yahoo still gets so much traffic on their homepage, and I so know what to do with it, you know?
That's a great call. That company kind of blows me away. I don't know if you've seen their latest ad campaigns, but they're miserable. They're like, Yahoo, it's you. I mean, what is this? Like, what does that do for anybody? Who cares about that ad? What does that motivate anyone to do anything? I mean
all they have to do is be like, Yahoo, come to our site right now, and we'll do something awesome, and it'll be so much better.
I know. So that would be a great company to run. I totally agree. That's another sleeper company. I mean, obviously, it's a huge company, but it's kind of been a sleeper lately. People don't really think about it that much, and it would be a blast. That would be a great one, too. I agree.
All right, next question.
I think it'd be great to run an American car company right now as well. I think that would be another one that would be kind of fun to do.
I agree. I totally agree.
You know, one more, if I may say, Sony would be interesting because Sony is kind of dead. Besides, you know, their gaming business, they're pretty much dead, and that would be a great one to do. They got such great brand recognition, great history. That'd be fun to do too. Okay, moving on. Sorry.
Do you invest in other companies? ComTop, that was a big part of VaynerMedia. I wanted to do that. I wanted to give sweat equity. And so, you know, I've invested in Tumblr. I've invested in Daily Booth. And there's several others I'm working on. It's very attractive for me to do it. I like it a lot. Reed, how about you?
I have not invested in another company yet, but I recently just joined the board of a company which I deeply believe in called Groupon. I don't know if you know about these guys, Gary, but you should.
Are you serious?
Groupon?
I know.
So I'm on the board. It's the first.
I've been talking to them. I'm in love with it.
They're great. So.
No! I'm a little confused, but I did see this from somebody. Can you send it? Wait a minute. Do you know Travis Kalanick? Is he involved in this?
I'm not sure.
How about Tay Rose? Somebody showed me this.
No.
I've seen this.
So Groupon is a brilliant idea. Okay, brilliant idea. What they basically are is every day, it's very Woot-like in a way, every day there's one deal, okay, that's available in a local market, and they have, I think, 20 cities or something, right? Once the deal tips, once enough people say, yeah, I'd buy this deal, then it's on, and everybody who put their money in gets a discount, and it's unbelievable. This is all public, by the way, so I can share these numbers. I think it was in the New York Times recently. Next year, they're planning on doing $100 million in revenue. Now, what's amazing about Groupon is that they're the first company I found that actually cracked the local market by doing the basic, simple fucking thing, which is giving everyone one great, huge discount a day in a local market and get everyone to talk about it and get everyone to tell their friends about it. Yelp's been trying to make money off local. Lots of people have been trying to make money off local. Groupon did it by doing the simplest damn thing, which is one great deal a day for a local business. And it's bringing these local businesses tremendous amounts of money and customers. There's a dentist. Real quick, I'll stop the pitch, but there's a dentist who offered, like, you know, dental cleaning or something. And they picked up, like, 2,000 new customers in one day. I have no idea how they would ever get 2,000 new customers in a year normally. And all they had to do was give a discount and use Groupon's mailing list to get the word out about it. So I'm involved with that company, but that's the only company I'm part of.
Listen, I have a site. If you go to right now, Power Crowd, it just says it works. I tried to launch 3 years ago. Almost identical business model.
Huh. What happened to it?
The same thing that always happens. I have too much shit going on.
So, anyway, Groupon is the only... I'd actually like to get involved. There's a company I really dig called Airbnb. Do you know them?
No.
All right, check this out. Go to AIRBNB.com. And what they are is... This is fucking brilliant because it's so disruptive and great. Instead of going to a city and getting a hotel room, you basically go to a city on the Airbnb site, and people are offering their own rooms in their houses or renting out a house for a weekend or whatever. So you can go and stay in someone's home instead of staying in a hotel room. It's significantly cheaper. You actually get to meet some interesting people, and you get a whole place to yourself instead of a hotel room.
It looks so Flickr-like.
Yeah, I'm loading it up right now. Yeah. All right, but go to New York. Check out New York, for example.
No, I mean, but like visually, it looks so much like Flickr, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does look Flickr-like. I agree. But go, like, try it sometime. It's such a great idea. It's such a great idea because it's a disruptive model. It gets sort of this... Hotels are fucking expensive. They're expensive. They never deliver on what you're paying $500 a night in New York to stay at a decent hotel. It's ridiculous. You know, you can stay at someone's house or some, you know, obviously if you're comfortable with this, but you can stay in an apartment or something else for a fraction of the price, get a much better place technically, have more room, and not feel like you're getting raped on price. It's just a great idea. Anyway, I love this company too, but I'm not involved with them at all.
Not yet or not going to be?
They haven't asked me or anything like that, but I know the guys there and I'm just very impressed with the company.
Yeah, no, it's pretty good.
They don't need my help. I mean, they're doing pretty well. But it's a great idea. I just love disruptive ideas like this. To me, Groupon is one of those. Airbnb is another one of those. And I think the hotel business is one of those businesses that is just ripe for disruption.
I think you're right. All right, let's go to the next question. M8 Media, I don't have stock options for VaynerMedia and or Wine Library, but it's not something I'm against. My dad is too old school with Wine Library, so that was just never a game I was going to win. I barely got him to believe that the employees weren't stealing from us, let alone stock options. With VaynerMedia, it's so new. We're going to come up with some stuff, I think, long term, but just trying to get a foundation for my brother, AJ. Just haven't been in a position to go there, but that's clearly something I'm more than fine doing. Jace?
I've never been a big fan of giving equity away. I think it's complicated. I just don't like complicated things. And it's structurally complicated to deal with stock, and especially for a private company. I think it also gives people a false sense of hope. And I don't feel like that's a fair thing to do. I'd rather give people cash than give them this stock that might be possibly worth something one day. So the way we do it at our company is we bonus generously at the end of the year. We do have a thing set up for our employees. If we do ever sell the company, which we have no plans to do, but if we ever do sell the company, they'll participate in that upside. But as far as, you know, stock that isn't worth anything right now, for a private company, there's really no value in stock unless people are buying it and selling it in some market. It seems to me just kind of like a false promise. So I've kind of stayed away from that.
Very interesting. All right, next question.
Yeah, let me take this one. This one's been asked a few times here. Survive to Five again. Can you elaborate on your beliefs about business plans? How should we approach planning? I think Gary and I probably agree with this. Agree on this one is that business plans are just pretty much a waste of time. Just go out and build something. That's your plan. Your plan is what you do. It's not what you talk about or what you think you're going to do. It's what you actually do. That's the plan. The product is the plan. The process is the plan. All that stuff's the plan, not the stuff you write about. So my general feeling is that planning is simply guessing. And if we stop thinking about plans as these really serious things, we won't take them as seriously. So instead of writing a business plan, think about writing a business guess. Call it a business guess. Or instead of strategic planning, you're doing strategic guessing. Or financial planning, you're doing financial guessing. And when you start thinking about it like that, I think you realize that plans simply are just guesses and you don't have to put that much weight into them.
I hate plans. I like process. I like knowing what you want to do every day. I like building something, but I think you've got to be massively reactionary because the market changes immediately. I think plans hurt people. I think plans hurt people. I think analytics hurt people. I think structure hurts people. It's why so many of the best entrepreneurs were not good students or rogue. But structure hurts people. It hurts creativity. Creativity is the secret sauce. The end.
Yeah, I like your point. What the hell? You just said something. I just forgot what you said. Something you said I really liked about. Oh yeah, analytics. Tell me about your feeling on that. People are obsessed with analytics. What do you think?
I think if you look at analytics, the first 18 months you run a business, you're out of business. I just hate them, Fried. I hate them. I hate that people look at it. I haven't looked at Google. The two things I hate more than life right now are SEO and analytics. I don't disrespect them. They have an enormous place. I get it. But for anybody who's an entrepreneur and is building a business for themselves, I think they are two of the biggest things that kill. Here's how I think SEO falls into place. SEO is this to me. It's like we're all in a mall. We all have stores in a mall, and there's only one entrance, and you have the first store in the mall, right? But if they come into your store and your store blows, you've lost. You didn't win. So it's like location. It's kind of like location, location, and retail. that doesn't always bode true. And I think SEO is the same exact thing, and I think people get completely, completely sidetracked by it.
That's cool. You should do something about that. I don't know if you've have you done a video on that before?
No, I'm going to start talking about that. You're right, I will. All right, everybody wants to know brand optimization question. Everybody loves the same question. How do you guys manage, figure out what to delegate to your employees, and how do you make sure they do a great job? Reed?
Well, I do what I'm good at, and I delegate things that I'm not good at to other people who are good at those things. I mean, it's really, it's as simple as that. I want everyone who's working on something to be working on the thing that they're best at. That's just the way I approach it, so that's kind of my answer.
Guys, that's Bill Belichick. Like, that's the Bill Parcells tree. Like, put the player in the best position to win. As simple as that. And for me, I don't even really pay attention, Brand, on what they're doing day to day. If I don't like what happened globally after 3 months, 6 months, it's over. Like, I will fire anybody in a heartbeat. You could do it any way you want, but you've got to execute. It doesn't really matter how to process there. You just got to execute. And so for me, figuring out what to delegate is cake. If I don't want to do it, I'm not doing it. And there's usually somebody way better than me to do it. And then how do I make sure they do a great job? I don't. I just look at the results. And when it's over, you make a decision.
Yeah, totally. And that's related to the next question here, which is how much do you leave to their judgment versus process? I leave just about everything to my employees' judgment. I don't even like to call them employees. I don't even like that word. So the people I work with, if I don't trust their judgment, what the hell are they doing working for me? Why did I hire them in the first place? You know, you've got to trust the people you work with, and you know, in some cases you work for. You've got to make sure that you're on board with what they believe and that they share the same point of view that you do and all those things. So if you're ever in a situation where you don't trust the people you have, that's your fault. Why are you hiring people like that? You know, you've got to hire the good people that really believe what you're doing.
Jason, you know what just blew me away? ComCop's question. Gary, do you use 37 products, and does Jason buy wine from Gary? And the fact that we both do commerce with each other is kind of very wild to me because, honestly, it's not like that for me with most people.
Yeah, I mean, I like to shop from people who like their products, you know? And so if there's a local coffee shop and the guy who owns it loves coffee, like, I'd rather go there than somewhere else. And for you, like, I'm not a big wine drinker, but when I do buy wine, I always get it from Wine Library. As long, you know, I didn't get it for a while because you weren't shipping to Illinois. But now that you're
right.
Shipped to Illinois, I buy everything from you. Why wouldn't I, you know?
Okay, Fred, I'll give you a little heads up. Tonight's Cinderella wine.
Yeah.
You drink Barolo? Have you ever had Barolo? You like Barolo?
I have had it, yes. It's like a big Italian wine, right?
Yeah, so we have one tonight that everybody's selling for $70, one guy's selling it for $60, and we're going to sell it for $38.
I'll have to buy that. I can't pass it a good deal either, man.
I know, man.
Why do you talk about that?
I will in a second. Let me just get in here, though. Here's what's funny about Fried's products. They're the best. See, we're one of the four or five best wine shops in the country. Fried products are the best, and everybody knows it, and that's just it.
Thanks.
I mean, Fried, you make really great products, and that's just the way it is. So I don't think I have a choice. I'm sure out of the 37 people in here, anybody who's doing any kind of project managing and things like that, they're buying your products. If they drink wine, they're not necessarily shopping with us all the time, you know?
They should be, though. They should be.
Survive says, build an audience by building a community, a la Ning Good. You know, it's funny. There's two sites that I will devour in 2010 and make my firm judgment on, and that is Ning and LinkedIn. So big year for me for those two platforms. I'm going to spend a lot of time in both, so I'll answer your question about Ning next year. Reed, any use of one of those two products?
No, I don't even understand Ning. I kind of get what they're about, but I don't get it.
I'll tell you very quickly. Pitch, WordPress, Facebook, WordPress, MySpace, WordPress, social media, social network.
Okay. I get that, I guess. I don't see the point, I guess, because, I don't know, I just feel like everyone's on Facebook. Everyone's doing the Facebook thing, and there's so many different ways to have groups on Facebook and that sort of thing that I have a hard time understanding why someone would have a very specialized social network. When people like, are people going to actually spend time there? Is my question. You know, I guess maybe it works. I don't know. I don't get it, but it may work.
So, Fried, So, Fried, I super trust you, and I'm really rolling the dice with the 37 people here.
Yep.
I'm going to say something right now that I'd like to keep as private as possible, but I'm also not ridiculous. Oh, man, do I... You know what? I'm going to hold it to... I really want to do this, and I don't know if I...
Wow.
There's something I really want to do, and I haven't totally figured it out. All right, I'll just say it because I'm not sure I can really get to it. Otherwise, I would have never brought this up. I think LinkedIn is fascinating. I want to know it cold. I think there's a huge opportunity for a lightweight LinkedIn. I think somebody can come in and do Twitter to Facebook to LinkedIn. I think there's a very lightweight LinkedIn opportunity out there, and I want to build it.
Yeah, I think LinkedIn is interesting. For me, I don't get it because...
I don't agree with Ellen 2007. She says LinkedIn's good enough. LinkedIn is fucking heavy.
It's way too heavy. Totally agree with that. Completely agree. And this is such a great example, as we were talking about earlier, about a company focusing on the basics. If you focus on the basics of what LinkedIn really is at its core, I think you can take them out. Because it is too complicated. There's too much shit going on LinkedIn. Now, that said, I know it's very valuable for people who are looking for jobs and looking for networking, especially salespeople who do professional networking and things like that. Like, it's not that LinkedIn isn't good. I just think that there's room, I totally agree with you, Gary, there's room for a much simpler version of LinkedIn.
I just want to have I want to call something like, you know, latenighthotelroom.com. Like, the shit that we do at conferences, Fried, at like 3 in the morning and just riff, I just want to go to a place where, like, give me something like Twitter meets LinkedIn where I can talk business all the time and not feel spammy because I love it. I just want to make deals and let's fucking do shit. That place is where I want to be on the internet right now. Show me the place where I can sign in and just see people who want a fucking deal. Hey, I got too much fucking, you know, stickers here. Who wants to trade them for, like barter? Like, I need something like fleamarket.com where we can just all go in there and be like, I'm looking for a designer and trade and, like, deal and, like, I'll sell you. I want to make shit happen, like Deal Center, you know? Like, that would be fucking awesome.
That would be fascinating to watch, too, just to be part of that. But I totally agree. That's cool. That is very flea market-like.
Yeah, like, can you imagine?
The deal side of it.
Yeah, like, I just want to go in there and be like, who wants to do some shit? Like, I want to get press for my fucking new site, Cinderella Wine. Who can write about it? Boom. And just not feel bad. Like, just all, like, raw. Like, red light district. Let's go.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, Fried, when you... Yeah. That sort of shit gets done. If you needed something real quick or you had a new product out, it'd be nice to go in there and be like, hey, this is what I want people to talk about. Like, who wants to do what? And then a ton of people come and do spammy shit and want to do JV this and deal this and if you do this, and you'll say no to all that. But a couple of people will be like, hey, I'll just cover that. You know, you scratch my back next time. Like, I just need... I need a raw kind of, like, raw place. You know?
Maybe what you ought to do is try and do it in person first, like rent out a big room somewhere and just say, show up, let's do business, and just see what, call it the Let's Do Business Conference, and there's no speakers, there's people there who show up who try and sell each other shit. It'd basically be like an open outcry, you know, basic fundamental economics market going on. I think that'd be a blast to be part of. You know, like, you ever go down to the floor? You ever been down on the floor, like the, you know, New York Stock Exchange, the Chicago Board of Options? Yeah, just like raw, like, give me five, I'll take some of it. Just totally raw, open market, anything goes. It could be, you might trade press for a product, or you might trade product for a product, or you might trade time for product, whatever the hell it is, you can bid and ask on anything. I think that'd be really damn cool. That'd be really, really fun to do, actually.
And I know a lot of people are mentioning Sprouter, and I know Sprouter... And that kind of goes in that direction, but I with a little bit more LinkedIn feature type stuff, like, I don't know, there's something there. Like, I just want people to be able to do things, you know?
Yeah, a lot less structure. I think that's a big part of it. I think, like you were saying earlier, structure is just going to get in the way here. I just like, that's why I just like the idea of, actually, I'd call it, like, the pit. I love the idea of, like, the trading pit. It's just, like, it is so fundamentally raw in terms of supply and demand and who wants this and who wants that. It's so many good things I think would come out of something like that. So that'd be a blast.
I don't know Woo Themes. I see somebody asking about Woo Themes. I'm not really sure.
I don't know what that is.
But that's like, you know, kind of like WordPress themes. And it's a pretty looking site, you know. I'm not super worried about themes that much, punk rock devil.
Hey, I'm going to take this. Let me take this car thing here. Lamborghini, Ferrari, Porsche, Maserati, Tesla. Pick one. I'm going to pick one that's not on the list. Aston Martin. I think Aston Martin makes the most beautiful cars on the road today. And the other thing that's great about Aston Martin is that all their cars are handmade. And that is something that's just like going away. People don't make cars by hand anymore, but the engines are handmade. The body panels are hand hammered. It's unbelievable to think that people still do this. And you have to have respect for a company that still makes things by hand, something that's so complex as a car. So that's my vote for cars.
My thing with things is very weird. I'm crazy. I don't want shit. I don't like cars. I don't want a plane. I don't like clothes. I don't like anything. I want my family to be healthy, and I want to buy the New York Jets, and I want to love what I do every day. My ambition or knowledge of stuff, like watches and ties, anything, is really poor. I could care less. I don't want it. I don't need it. And I want to buy it. I want to buy a football team. That's about it.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that.
I wish I liked objects more. I really do, because it's kind of cool. I just don't.
Yeah, the thing I like about, I don't like collecting objects and having clutter. I don't like that sort of thing, but I love objects that someone really cared about. I love, like, things that someone put their heart and soul into. I mean, you're into businesses, Gary. You love the process of business. The same thing is alive with objects. Like, looking at a beautiful watch that someone actually, you know, people, it's unbelievable. People still make watches by hand. Like,
it's incredible.
Unbelievable.
I don't understand it. Like, knowing you as I do, I know you love architecture, and I'm like, so fascinated that people understand that. Like, I'll go look at a building, and I'll see, like, people outside of New York, because I'm so lucky to live in Manhattan, people just looking at the building, and I'll hear things like, that is just incredible. And I'll look, and I'll be like, what, the pigeon? I'm like, that crap on the, I'm not capable. I'm not good at that. I don't get it.
Well, you know what you should do sometimes? Seriously, you should go on a tour and slow down for a minute and look around closely at things, like an architecture tour, and maybe you get some appreciation for it. But maybe it's not architecture, maybe it's something else. But the point is, like, my fascination with objects is not, like, to show off or to have something no one else has.
I know that. I know that.
Yeah, I know. I'm just saying in general, like, I think a lot of people think of objects in that way, and I think that's unfortunate. But to actually see an object that someone put everything they had into making it just as perfect as they possibly could and cared about it as deeply as you care about the things that you do, to me, that's just a great thing to be able to hold on to. Because, Gary, I can't hold on to you, you know what I mean? But I can hold on to a watch, or I can drive a car that someone cared about so much that I can have that thing. And to me, that's just the great thing about those sorts of high-level objects. It doesn't have to be expensive either. It can be a small piece of wood that someone cared about that much, you know? I love that.
It's funny. That's what I think about parenting. I am obsessed with good parents. Like, when I look at a parent that clearly has done a great job, when I meet a great kid and their parent, you know, it's crazy, Freed. Why don't you tell everybody the story about your parents coming to my book signing? I don't think you understand, when I hit you up the other day, how much of an impact that had on me.
That's
like,
cool. Man. My parents went to the book signing. But here's the thing, you know, so parents are super important, obviously. When I was growing up, I ran track. I was really good at track. And I played basketball my freshman year. Now, I'm too short to play basketball, like, after freshman year, but I played freshman year. And I never played. I got into, like, one or two games. But my parents were at every single game. Every single game, and I was actually very good at track, but they were at every single track meet I was at. Every single track meet. And that sort of shit is, like, you can't put a value on that. That is so, like, to have that level of support is so important to people. And so, I'll never forget that about my parents. Like, just the fact that they were there no matter what, truly no matter what, was a huge impact on me. So, it's huge.
I mean,
you gotta have that kind of support.
Knowing who you are as a person and the respect I have for you, when they came up and said that they were Jason Fried's parents, like, the way I looked at them, it was incredible. Like, to me, you know, you want to talk about somebody putting everything they have into something, fuck a watch and a car and a business. A parent putting into a child, that is it, right?
That's cool. That's a good way to think about it. Yep.
And it was amazing how immediately I was, like, I felt attached to them, and I was so pumped they were there. because I thought I had a pretty good talk, and I was pumped and proud to think that they were going to come back and tell you that I was a good dude and I did a good job, you know?
Yeah, they loved your talk, man. They loved it. So
that's awesome. That's awesome. Cool. Any media says, you say LinkedIn is heavy. The travel industry is the same way. What do you suggest to disrupt travel? Well, I think Jason just showed us a site that disrupted travel. Any media, I'm not sure exactly what you mean. You're going so global. LinkedIn is not an industry. LinkedIn is a product that I think is heavy. You know, travel's been disrupted by tons of sites. You know, I don't really, you'd have to be a lot more detailed to what you really mean.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't travel that much, so I don't really know. I just, you know, I actually don't use those travel aggregation sites because I don't like not knowing which airline I'm going to fly. I have my favorite things, so I'll, you know, I always try to fly in Southwest first. So I'll go to Southwest site and try and book a flight. By the way, that's something I love about Southwest. Southwest does not participate, as far as I remember. They may have changed that, but I don't think they have. They don't participate in any of those aggregate pricing search sites. You want to buy a ticket from Southwest, you go to southwest.com. And I love that. I think they're still doing that. I've always loved that about them. They play their own rules. They play by their own rules, and it's great.
Yeah, I agree. All right, you take the next one, man.
Yeah, so this one keeps coming up, so let me get this. Devon Koshel, I think is how you might pronounce it. JF, were you paranoid about web app security when you first launched your first app? I wasn't paranoid about it. Some of our customers initially were afraid of hosting stuff remotely, and I totally get that. It makes complete sense to me. But at the end of the day, you're not going to convince anybody that something you're doing is more or less secure than they're comfortable with. They're only going to convince themselves of that. And that just takes time. It's a cultural thing. People have to become comfortable with it and familiar with it. And, you know, 10 years ago, people were terrified to bank online. Now everyone banks online. So it's just a matter of time. Things change, and I'm not out to convince people, you know, to do something they're not comfortable with. I don't want people to do things they're not comfortable with. If you're not comfortable with it, maybe you'll be comfortable with it a year, and we'll be around when you're ready. But I'm not going to sit around and try and tell you something that's going to make you uncomfortable right now.
I mean, this was the whole argument I always had in 07, 08. People are like, Gary, how do we convince people Twitter's real? I'm like, you're the same people that are going to be pissed when everybody knows it's real, and you're going to say, jump the shark. I mean, people are going to, there's early adopters and there's not, and it's very obvious to me. I mean, people said, Jason, remember when people were like, I won't get a cell phone, why would I want anybody to reach me anytime they wanted?
Of course, yeah.
I mean, do you remember how many people said they never get a Facebook? So, I agree with you totally. Hey, Fried, I like this one, talking about monetizing. Would you guys be willing to do a podcast like this on a regular basis? I'd pay money to subscribe to a weekly pit session. Fried,
absolutely.
Business time. Let's do it this way. My time is very valuable. Quarter path. What are you willing to pay for this on a weekly basis?
That's a good question back to them. Let's see what they say.
A bottle. I'm $10 a week. The problem is for, you know, it sucks because I'd love to do something regularly like this. The problem is that content's value is so low now.
Here's the thing, man. I actually disagree. So I think that there's a huge opportunity being lost by so many people who make content today thinking that they have to give shit away for free. I think...
Yeah, I understand, but free. CoderPath will pay $40 a month for four sessions, $10 a week for, let's say, an hour, right? The problem is that if I do specific talks with a client, I can get 5,000. Right? Now, you can build brand, and it's always worth giving back, and I do tons of stuff for free, so I get it. But content's value to monetize is at all-time low because it's so out there. On the flip side, I believe its value is greater than ever because it's a cost of entry to be in the game.
Yeah, but I think you're thinking small about it. I mean, this guy's going to pay $40 a month to get 10,000 people pay $40 a month. You know you can find 10,000 people who'd be interested in this sort of stuff. Then you're really talking. You know, then you're seriously talking. And not only that, you don't have to go out and find those individual clients anymore. That's the thing with client business that you're in right now. You've got to find new clients all the time. I mean, hopefully you keep your clients, but you have to find new ones, presumably. When you have a subscription-based business and someone's paying you $40 a month and you've got 10,000 people, 100 can leave and 100 can come in, 1,000 can leave and 1,000 come in. You're not obsessed about every next client you might have to get. So I actually think you'll make a ton more money and actually enjoy it more when you're doing the content and you're selling the content yourself rather than having to do stuff for other people. So
I totally agree. I totally agree with you. I mean, but look on the flip side, watch this. How many of you guys, no matter if we did this, would just not pay for this because you feel like you can get it from us in different ways and other stuff's out there? You know, please answer right now. How many of you just would not pay, even if it was $10 a month? Just curious.
And while people are saying that, let me throw something in. I think a good model for this is actually those stock market newsletters, which is an enormous business.
Right.
I don't know if it still is. I think it probably still is. But people are paying hundreds and hundreds of dollars a year, some even thousands of dollars a year, to get market commentary from an expert. And the truth is there aren't that many experts in the market. No one knows what the fuck's going on half the time anyway. There's a ton of free information about the market today that was never around before, and these newsletters are still selling. So I think people are absolutely willing to pay for something, but the big problem with the internet today is that if you don't charge money for something, no one can pay you for it. So people think everything's free because people are afraid to charge. And I actually like what Rupert Murdoch's going into. I like this idea of trying to charge for his stuff. I think it's a great experiment. Why the hell not? You know, you can't expect to get paid if you don't put a price on something. So let's see what happens. Anyway,
I think the best question or answer was by Devin Cushall, said, depends if it was Q&A. I think the value explodes if it's Q&A, you know?
Yeah, because you're hearing, you know, yeah, I totally agree. I don't like the lectures, you know. The lectures aren't that valuable, but the back and forth, the Q&A, that stuff has got to be valuable. And it's something that you don't get because it's kind of hard to write a Q&A thing. It's really about in the moment, what's the answer, you know, that sort of thing. And that's where I think the real value is.
Yeah, I agree. All right, let's keep going here.
Anyway,
fire up questions.
Kind of
there's a lot of people that have been quiet that are in here. Please just say hello at least, because I'm really thankful you're here, and thank you for buying the books and all that. Please, please, please jump in here and say hello at least. Just say hi. Thank you. Thank you, Beast Tank 12. There we go. Yes, like Ryan, you've not been quiet. You've done a good job. The hockey player asks, when's the next book rolling out? You know, it's funny. I feel like I sold so hard with Crush It, and I was in sell mode so hard, but I feel like I might not write a book next year, Fried.
You should take a year off. Why not?
Yeah, I think I'm going to take a year off because I don't know how to, or there's only one of two things that are going to happen. Either I'm going to not write a book and then come back in 11 and do my normal Gary thing that's comfortable to me, which is sell, 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 or I might stun the world, write a book next year, and not hard sell at all, and do something creative. I don't think I can hard sell. It's just I can't. And so I don't know. I've got some, you know, those are the two options. I will not do what I did this year.
I think what would be cool for you to try as an experiment, which would be totally sort of against what you're used to, is to sort of embrace scarcity a bit. Because you are so accessible and you're so everywhere all the time, and I know that's what you love to be, but I think it could be kind of interesting if you did take a year off, you didn't write a book, and you didn't churn out some certain content, and took a year off and see what happens with scarcity. So when you come back, people are going to be like super pumped about where you've been, what you've been doing the whole time. And
all you smarter guys have been telling me this. I mean, I was with Godin the other day. He's so hot on it. He, like, wants to pay me to do it. He's so hot on it. He's just, you know, and I want to. Like, there's so much of me that wants to go into a cocoon, not do a single video, talk, anything. Just go into this crazy cocoon, like, show up in 2011 with a big-ass beard. Like, there's such a romantic thing about that. First of all,
right. There's
a big part of me that realizes that, first of all, the problems are this. One, it's not in my nature because I love interacting. Two, I would miss people. I love it. Three, I don't think of myself big enough to do it in a lot of ways, right? You know, I get that I am to my small audience, but I can't think of myself as like, that's cool, like, yeah, now I'm back, right? But it's so romantic to me. I desperately want to go in a cave, knock it out of the fucking park for Cork, Cinderella Wine, Gourmet Library, VaynerMedia, and I think to some degree 2010 for me will be a dramatically quieter, more scarce year, because I just want to be in learn mode and be off the grid. It would be fascinating. I think it would be massively interesting.
I think you should try. I know it would be super hard for you to try, but I think it would be kind of cool. I think it would be – I think people would look forward to that, too.
Reed, why don't we reverse? Why don't you come out videos and answer every tweet and answer every email and go to 900 conferences and do 50 trillion view streams, and I'll be all quiet.
You know, I've actually been slowly moving into that role. So I've been getting a lot more involved with Twitter. Actually, something I'm doing too is, I don't know if you know about this, Carrie, but you might even want to think about doing this, although you kind of do it all the time, I guess. I'm doing the CEO office hours concept. Have you heard about this?
No, I missed my radar. Go ahead.
It's okay. So what I'm doing is every Tuesday and Thursday from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. Central, so for 2 hours a day, twice a week, I put my phone number online, a special phone number, and anybody can call me one-on-one directly and have between a 5 and 10 minute conversation about anything. People can ask about products. People can ask about business advice. People can throw their idea by me and see what I say about it or whatever and give them feedback. So it's basically a one-on-one Q&A twice a week for 2 hours for free as a way to kind of give back and also get a little bit closer to our customers. So that's something I'm doing, which I'm really enjoying as well.
You're going to love this. So a lot of people have now been open to the idea of me doing a business show on TV. And one of the concepts I have, if I do it, it's going to be Charlie Rose meets Donny Deutsch meets Party of Five, where they ate, you know, I want to do this, like, you'll be on my show, I'll interview you over a glass of wine, we'll do some Q&A with the crowd, and then I kick you off and I do 3 minutes of Wine Library TV at the end. That's kind of like the pitch, right? Anyway, I'm kind of romanced by the idea, and one of the big things I want to do on the show is I'm going to put my phone number permanently on the screen forever. Like, I'm going to have a phone that is just available to America, and I will answer it all fucking day.
Right.
it would be so insane.
Now, here's the reason why I didn't do that, because I actually want people to know that I am going to be at that number for these 2 hours, so they are guaranteed to have a shot to actually talk, because what I'd be afraid of is if I put a number up all the time, I wouldn't really take it seriously because I've got other things to do. So it's no fair to somebody if I'm out of town or I'm in a meeting for 3 hours and you can call me when you can.
You're exactly right. Now, Joe Hampus, you're right. Not only America, I just said it that way, and I understand, but you know me. I'm insane. I'll just answer it all the time. Just like, listen, proof is in the pudding. It's what I do on Twitter and email and Facebook, you know?
I love it. I mean, I love the idea. Why the hell not? You know, why not do that? So this is my sort of start in trying to do that and trying to be a little bit more back and forth with people on a regular basis.
This is a lot of fun for me. For example, I mean, listen, for the cost of entry, I mean, it's absurd. People are paying $800 and going to conferences and getting dick. These guys bought 2 books that probably cost them $30. We've done this. We're doing this for 3 hours, you know?
Right.
I mean, yep. I mean, these 36 people won. Like, they're like, people are going to be like, what? Like, people didn't really know about this because we tweeted a couple times. We kept it fairly under the radar. I mean, and it was about 100 buys, so about 60 people couldn't even make the time. But, you know, it's pretty cool, you know? You know?
That, and I got to say, I totally appreciate people buying my book because it's not even out yet. So that takes a big leap for someone to spend $15 on something they won't have for 5 months. So I really want to say that I appreciate everyone who bought Rework as well.
Yeah, and guys, honestly, I'm so positive Rework is going to be so awesome, and I'm just really glad that you guys, you know, everybody knows my gratitude. It's what I'm driven by, and thank you. Reed, why don't you give us a little Rework preview, like something. Give us a, you know, I know you want to keep it there, whatever, but give us a little something.
Sure. Well, first of all, Gary, I would send you a book, but I know you don't read books, so, you know, what are you going to do with it? Burn it?
That's right. No, I appreciate it, but you're right. I'll never read it.
You'll never read it, so I'm not going to waste it on you. But if you want to read it, let me know. I'll send it to you. Rework is all about sort of our – the way I like to look at it is this. Rework is our cookbook, as if we were chefs. So a chef comes out and they write a cookbook about, you know, the recipes that they cook in the restaurant or at home, whatever. They give you all their secrets. Here's how you make your recipes. Here's how you make my recipes. Here you go. Have it. $20 or whatever. And we're not cooks, but we cook a business, basically. And so – Rework is basically our cookbook. It's all the recipes, all the things that we know about business, about hiring, about selling, about marketing, about designing, productivity tips, pretty much everything that we know is in this book. And it's not just about how to build a big business, because I think growth is totally overrated. I am a fan of keeping things as small as you can for as long as you can. And so this book is not about building a big, huge business. It's not about small as a stepping stone that you step on and you get over it and you get this big, huge business. It's about finding the right size. the right size might be 10 people, it might be 30, it might be 300 or 3,000. You don't really know. But the goal should not be to build a huge business. I think that's just the wrong way to think about business. So we talk a lot about that in the book as well. And we'll be releasing some stuff about it shortly, actually, a little bit more. We'll be putting the table of contents up shortly and putting a few essays up shortly. But it's still a little bit early, I think, for us to be giving away specific chapters. But we'll be slowly letting them out over time over the next few months.
Reed, for some reason, my middle bar got vanished. Oh, here, it's starting up again. Okay, but you're going to have to ask the next question because I can't see stuff.
Oh, okay. My bad. All right, let's see. What are the questions? I don't see any questions here, actually.
Is it the same issue?
No. Yeah, actually, it hasn't loaded up here. Okay, now they're starting to come through. Sorry about that, guys. So this guy's asked Elevate ETC or Elevate VC, actually. What safeguards do you have in place to make sure your company keeps its focus? You know, one of the things that allows us to keep our focus is by staying small. I think discipline is just hard for human beings in general. And a great way to be disciplined is to force yourself to be disciplined. So we have a very small team. We have 16 people now, which is relatively small considering the amount of customers we have and everything. So by staying small, you basically force yourself to not be able to do too much. So we can't build 5 more products. We just don't have the people. We can't do a lot of things that I'd ultimately kind of like to do if I could. And it keeps us honest by staying small. So the best thing we can do to stay focused is to keep our team as small as we possibly can and just have people we need now. I think too many companies are hiring people in anticipation of who they're going to need. And what happens is that you end up building these big teams that you have to keep busy on things that don't really matter. So when you keep your team small, everyone is working on something that matters because that's you only have a limited amount of time and a limited amount of people. If you have a lot of extra people, you're spending a lot of time on things that don't actually matter. And that's where companies start to go off track. They start to release too many things and do too many things and dabble in too many areas because they have to keep people busy. So that's the big takeaway I can give you on that one.
For me, it's like it's so easy because, you know, it's so easy to stay focused when you love it, right? And so that is quite big for me. And employees that don't love it won't be as good. And sometimes you need people, that, you know, Wirelab has almost 100 employees. Stock guys and cashiers, I wouldn't say are massively over the top passionate. But, you know, you try to make it good for them and try to make it interesting. And you create an environment where they can grow. I mean, some of the most, you know, the lead wine, the guy who runs the wine department was a stock guy at $10 an hour, makes 6 figures in his pump, you know, things like that. Somebody's asking a good question I want to answer. It says, can you elaborate on building tunnels? So, Fried, one of the books I'm thinking about writing is called Tunnels. And it stands for how you create multiple revenue streams, how to monetize in different places. See, what I think is interesting is that everybody's confused. Everyone's like, how do you monetize? What are the new ways to monetize? The new ways to monetize are the old ways to monetize. You can only really do the same thing that's always been done. You can either be in retail, or in the service business, the events business, you know, advertising. Nothing's really changed. And so, I see a very interesting world brewing. I actually think that Neiman Marcus and Saks Fifth Avenue should put Vogue out of business. I think that Reebok and Adidas should put ESPN out of business. I really think that products and retail can get into the content game now, because I think church and state is changing because you can't hide anymore with social media, so we're not as worried about the lines of church and state.
That's interesting. No, tell me about that. Like, how would Saks Fifth Avenue hurt Vogue? Like, what you're talking about, they should be producing the content because they have the products, they know most about the products? Is that what you're thinking?
Well, my thinking is that they're in position to do it. They've got the relationships. Yeah. They've got commerce-driven relationships with the designers. They're in position to do it. Back to my whole thesis of content, monetizing context at an all-time low, but content value is at an all-time high. You know, it's the honey you need to bring in the bees. I think that Saks.
Right.
Listen, I'm redesigning winelibrary.com next year, so that the first thing the top of the site is going to be basically the latest blog post, and we're going to just talk about wine. Bottom line.
Yep.
And we'll become a direct competitor. We'll become a direct competitor to the Wall Street Journal's wine section and Wine Spectator, and on. Content is the cost of entry.
Yeah, and wine, you know, why wouldn't you do that? You know, it makes so much sense now when you start to think about it. I think the big media or the big companies like Saks and Neiman Marcus, they're probably afraid that they're going to offend the magazine business. They're going to offend the people who write reviews, and so that's why they're afraid to do it. But someone's going to do it. Someone's going to do it.
For sure. Looks like we lost
something. I want to add about this, actually, real quick. I don't know if tunnels is related to this idea, but something we have in Rework, and I've been talking a lot about over in the conferences I've been doing lately, is this idea of selling your byproducts. The idea that there's all these old industries like agriculture and oil and lumber. These industries figured out that you can't make just one thing. You're always making something else. So when you cut boards, you're making sawdust. And sawdust is something you can sell also, and you're getting it for free. And the trick is, though, in the service business and the software business especially, people don't see their byproducts because they're not sawdust. It's not something that's so obvious. But you cannot make just one thing. So when we make a product, we learn about making a product, and we can turn that into a book and make a few million bucks selling a book. You know, when we build Basecamp, we also built Ruby on Rails. Ruby on Rails is simply a byproduct of building a product. And so there's all these things that you're churning off all the time. There's so many opportunities to make money out there on stuff that you don't even know you're making, but you're also making. So that's the other thing I wanted to throw in.
Well, it's funny, Fried. I mean, we recorded this, right?
Yep.
And so that's funny, CoderPath. You know, in theory, there's a lot of good stuff in here. You could conceivably sell this as an audiobook as the 3-hour jam session. People would buy it. I mean,
exactly.
You know, you got to be careful with the cheesy line, you know, that line in the sand of being cheese or not, but the fact of the matter is there's a lot of people who buy it and get a lot of value out of it.
No question. I mean, something I'd like to see, something I've wanted to do for a while, which has never gotten around to it, is I want to run a bunch of A-B tests on our site. So, you know, which page converts better, and this is kind of getting into analytics a bit, but, you know, which one converts better in the whole thing, and then I want to take those results. Usually companies would hold those results really close to their chest. I want to put an ebook out talking about here are the 15 designs we tested on BasecampHQ.com. Here's the one that worked the best. Here's why. Here's the one that worked the second best. Here's why. And basically share all that and sell it. I could sell that ebook for $20 and I could sell thousands of them. I could generate hundreds of thousands of dollars on revenue on something I was only originally doing for myself to learn about which page converts better. So I can learn which page converts better and I can make a few $100 selling that content. So there are just so many opportunities for people today. I can't understand when people don't know how to make money online. I hear it all the time. How do you monetize? You monetize by selling something. That's the only way you can monetize something. You got to sell something.
They're scared. They're scared to go there because there's just been, you know, it's almost like the corporate world and industrial America back in the day created school and wanted everybody to kind of work a certain way. Well, this whole movement was so built by the hippie Zen world that they've almost built the counterculture to it.
Right. Totally. They're actually, a lot of them are, I mean, it's not really fair to generalize this much, but I think you're kind of right. I mean, there's a lot of people who are afraid of business, who are trying to run businesses, and it just doesn't work. It doesn't make sense. So, anyway.
Yep.
That's their problem.
No, it's very, you know, and I think the Shane 100 writes the whole scratch your own itch. Boy, oh boy, do I believe in that. Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely. No question. Let me answer this one here. Survive to five again. How long do you think it'll learn to take, or how long do you think it'll take one to learn how to make money? So this is something I wrote about recently, which I think is important. Some people I think are born to make money. I think Gary's one of those people. I feel like I'm probably one of those people. I just know how to do it. I know how to run a business. I know how to make money. Just like there's some people who are really damn good at playing guitar and playing piano. But I think it also just takes a lot of practice. And just like anything, if you want to be good at it, making money is a skill, just like anything else you get good at is a skill. If you want to be a really good piano player, you got to play piano for 10 years, and you got to keep practicing. And making money is no different. So the sooner you start, the better off you're going to be, which is, again, why I advocate bootstrapping your business, because you're forced to make money. And then 5 years in, you're going to be really fucking good at making money. Unlike your competitors who are still, you know, they're just focused on spending money. They don't even know how to make it yet. And then 10 years down the road, you're going to be able to make money doing anything. I feel like I'm sort of at that point now where I can sell anything.
I can just make money. I just know how to do it. It's an innate skill that I have now that I've been developing over a long period of time. I can't play piano because I haven't focused on that, but I've been focused on making money. So I just think it's a matter of practice and time. That's my general take on that.
Yeah, and basically, since I've only done that my whole life, I mean, I didn't care about anything. That's why I failed all my classes. But I was always focused on my baseball card price guide and, you know, how I was going to make money. I think there's a lot to that, you know? But I think it's imperative to know oneself, Jace. I really think it is. I think inner, you know, being able to rise above yourself and look at yourself. Oh, quick, Ryan, good call. I just really think that that's a big one. If you really focus on what you're about, then it becomes even easier.
That's the thing. You know, some people aren't going to be good at it. Just like some people aren't good at other things too. That's totally fine. But I do think that it needs to be, like, making money needs to be demystified. It can't be this thing that only certain people know how to do. Anyone can learn how to do it. You just need to practice it. But you may not be good at it, but you still can learn how to do it. And I think that's the important part.
Reed, I pulled off a pretty big coup. Does anybody in this room have Tebow? Reed, do you have Tebow?
No, I have a Comcast DVR thing. Why, what's up? What'd you do?
Well, I'm on, the homepage of Tebow.
Oh, that fucking happened. What is this thing? Let me check it out.
They reached out to me. I'm starting to see some tweets come through. It's pretty cool. Anybody who
Where are you? I'm on Tebow. Oh, like on the Tebow unit itself, you mean?
On the Tebow unit itself.
Because I'm looking at Tebow.com. I didn't see it.
Hoping that somebody in this room's got it. Anybody in this room have Tebow? At all? Let's see, Eva. Yes, got Tebow. Robert, let me know.
We can share screenshots, but I don't think you can upload a screenshot to
the... Let me know. Let me know, Robert, if you see it. Anyway, it's just... oh, nice. Big Bot, you see it? We should... Yeah, why didn't we use Campfire, Freed?
I don't know, man. We should have. Next time we'll do that.
Okay. all right, let's go to the next...
We didn't, but hey.
Kind of funny.
So wait, why are you on there? Is it promoting something you're doing, or I don't get it.
It's crazy how good the placement is. It's almost like being on the homepage of Google, and at the bottom it just says, check out Wine Library TV. It's got this big yellow star, and it says, check out Wine Library TV, get the season pass. It's just they're fans. They're big fans of the show, and you can get Wine Library TV on Tebow now. And we did that a few months ago, and now... it's like promoted, like on the default homepage, I think. That's why I'm really curious to see Big Bot and Rob tell me exactly what it looks like. They showed me a screenshot. I mean, if it's what I think it is, it's pretty absurd.
That's crazy. Well, watch and see what happens. If your subscriptions go up too, I'm curious.
Yep. So,
what are the questions? The questions are starting to fade here. Who's got some questions?
Here we go. Should I create my Twitter username with my name or my website name? I love your name because it goes with you forever. You know, if I was Wine Library TV, I'd be in a really weird spot today since I have the passion for business as well. You evolved. So, I mean, you should have both. There's Gary Vee and there's Wine Library. I think both is the real way to go.
Yeah, I've got Jason Fried, and we've got 37 Signals. So we've done both too. I think that, you know, Gary talks about personal branding and the whole thing. So you gotta grab your name if you can, because who knows what you'll be doing in 10 years? Will you be working for the same company? Will you be doing the same thing? Who knows? But you'll still be that person. So you gotta grab your name if you can.
Nice. Keep the questions coming, fellas.
Yeah, Rob Murray, 98. What do you think about utilizing services like Squarespace to create your site? I think you should use whatever is simplest to build your site. What's most important is that you have the site up.
And if Squarespace is a beautiful product, so if you like Squarespace, use that. If you like TypePad, use that. If you like WordPress, use that. It doesn't really matter which tool. It's not about the gear.
Reed, are you a big Squarespace fan considering they sell?
Yeah, well, I like that they charge for the product. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, and, you know, Anthony, the product used to be free, and there's a free trial, I think, and now they only charge for it, if I remember correctly. I don't know if they have a free version anymore. I love it. I love people. This is the thing. There's so many free blogging tools out there. You're like, how could anyone compete by selling it? Well, people are doing really, really well selling it. You know, you can sell something if it's good. I think blogging software is a perfect example of that, and it sort of kills that how do you compete with the competition if it's free model. Well, you do something different, you do it better.
He gives a 14-day trial period.
Okay. But there's no free version, though, right? You can't, like, have Squarespace for free.
That's like, right. And by the way,
yeah.
I love that because that's like freemium. But I will say this. I don't think that people, period, truly comprehend how much ad revenue is going to be sucked into this world. If you've got the patience to wait 5 years, 7 years, you're going to be absolutely stunned. And I don't think you should have to wait. I'm just saying people are underestimating the enormity of money in advertising that's going to be put in online advertising in the next 5 to 10 years. Just enormous. Yeah, Jace, that's fascinating.
I don't know much about that world. I don't know much about that world, so I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers are going to be so staggering, and so if you're .wordpress.org, whatever, or, you know, thehouse.blogspot.com, the mothership is going to have a pretty big opportunity to monetize that traffic.
Yeah, you would think so.
I mean, I'll give you a great example. I would create a blogging platform right now. You know what mine would be called? Top Right Box. And it would be a blogging platform, and you get a free version, but I would control the Top Right Box. And that ad unit, I would make $1 trillion on soon.
I wonder why. Well, I thought, I'm not sure why no one does that, actually.
Well, because there's just so many things. Nobody's thinking about it, and that's how I think, right? I'm like, okay, wait a minute. If I was WordPress, and I controlled the Top Right Box, and it would be one ad for the day, and it would be one product, I could make $5 million a day from new product launches from Procter & Gamble.
That's actually interesting. That's something we do on the deck. You can buy the deck network.
You know what I think about the deck.
Yeah, you love the deck.
I love it. I mean, every day. So that's what I think about. Like, I'd want to launch a blogging platform, and I wouldn't charge, but I would control the ad in the top right spot, and it'd be bomb ass, and that would be it. And I would only run one ad for one day, and you would make a. Could you imagine all the WordPress sites in the world right now, and there's a box in the top right, and they host? I mean, that's crazy.
It is. Now, what do you think about the fact that you wouldn't be able to be very relevant? It would just have to be, basically, to be a big brand, right?
Yeah, I mean, big brands don't give a fuck, you know? Big brands, I mean,
yep.
When movies come out, they don't fucking care. When big brands come out, they don't care. You know, there's consumer brands. People are not paying attention. So, as you can tell, my body language is talking a lot about consumer brands. I'm going to buy the Jets because I'm going to own that world. I firmly believe it. I mean, there's so much money in the Procter & Gambles and the Duracells and the Pepsis and the Gatorades and the Doritos and the Lysols and the... I mean, consumer brands have spent so much money on traditional media that sucks that when that shift happens, and it's starting to happen, man, it's like a fucking landslide. I'm seeing all the little pieces of rocks starting to fall. I see the tree moving. You know what I mean, Fried? It's like the rain's pounding and you're just watching, and then all of a sudden, that whole... side of the mountain falls, that's what I think is going to happen.
Where's it going to fall into? Like, where's it going to go, really?
It's going to go online, and it's going to go into mobile. It's going to go onto the internet, right? And so, you know, the real players, the people that are sitting there waiting are going to win. I mean, it's kind of like the people that were sitting... Amazon, they were sitting there, they won. Like you said, I'm not going to convince anybody. They'll be here, right? Just like winelibrary.com in 97. The first 3 years, I didn't sell dick. But guess what? When everybody started to kind of buy stuff online in 01, I was right there. You know, the banks that were online, people were scared of it, but when they came, the people that are more prepared and better at it, they won. When advertising really comes to the internet, and it's not here. People don't get it. It's not. It's in television, and it's in print, and it's in radio, and it's in billboard. When it comes to the internet for real, it's going to be insanity. It's going to be a lot of money there, my man.
Do you think that ads, do you think that ads work as well as they used to work?
No, ads don't convert. They convert at 12%, and word of mouth converts at 80%. Why do you think I'm a living, breathing social product?
Right, so why are you so bullish on ads moving online? Like, obviously, just because money's going to pour into it, but...
That's a very good point, and the reason is it's going to take a good 15 to 20 years for the culture to shift. That's all. I don't. If you want to talk about 30 years from now, fine, but culture, it's going to be too long. Reed, every decision, every 37-year-old to 42-year-old right now in corporate America that's going to be the 55-year-old that makes the decision is still going to be buying some form of ads. It's too much in the culture. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Just like all of us, even in us.
What I'm wondering is, do you see a new, like, so, okay, ads are going to go from print to online. I think we all get that, and TV to online. So are they still going to be the same thing just online, or is there going to be something new that's coming to advertising that you see?
I think experience ads. I'm telling you, man, if Bezos launches a new Kindle, he's a moron not to allocate the day and take over sites for just 8 hours Q&A. You know, Fried, can you imagine if we were doing this for the last 3 hours, but let's say it was specifically talking about our books? I would pay so much more if Mashable and TechCrunch and Godin's blog would let us take over the top right corner and make an experiential ad, because we would convert, because people would hear our voices and see our faces, and they'd want to buy it.
Yep.
So
yep.
No. I think things will become experiential. Yeah.
Cool. Let's see.
All right.
you want to take the president one?
What's the president
voter path? If you could give Obama one piece of advice, what would it be?
I would say for him to leverage, you know, what I know best, which is for him to leverage new media a little bit more. I think a lot of his stuff is, you know, controlled, and I know there's laws and rules with presidents and this and that, but, you know, don't forget, Fried, you're talking to the guy who called out Obama for not doing Twitter himself, right?
Yeah.
You know, and that recently has come out and stuff. I just think he could have been he has so much to gain with his charisma. You know, nobody's busier than president. Give me 15 minutes. Give me 15 minutes of Ustream. Give me 15 minutes to do a quick video. Just be even more raw. Even more raw.
Yeah. That's such a cultural change. I mean, I totally agree. That'd be badass. I just wonder when that'll happen. Because it will happen. I just wonder when it will happen. If it doesn't happen with Obama, like, is there anyone even coming up next who's going to be into that? I feel like there's sort of that rare opportunity for someone to break through on that right now. And then if Obama doesn't break through on that, I'm not sure the next guy's going to break through on that. It's going to be
I guess. Yeah, I think it's going to be a while.
Yeah. That's kind of cool, though. So I'll take this one here. Click Ryan 72. What is the future of new media in the next 12 to 18 months? I'm just going to tell you, I could care less about the future of anything. So my whole point of view is you've got to worry about today and tomorrow. Nail today and tomorrow, and the future will be there for you. But if you're always focused on what the next thing is going to be down the road, I think you're just missing the stuff that really matters, which is today. So that's my whole take on predicting the future and where things are going. I'm not really that concerned. As long as I pay attention to every single day that's in front of me, I'll get there, and I'll be fine. So that's my take on it.
Yeah, I'm a very, I have a whole chapter, and I talk about a lot about in my book about reactionary business, you know? I think that it's very hard to look in the future. It really doesn't matter. Nobody can really predict it. I think about it constantly, but I don't make decisions about it. Oh, that's interesting. That's the first time I've ever articulated that. I think about it constantly. Huh.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. There's a guy named Ricardo Semler who wrote a great book called Maverick, which is a great, great book. And he talks just about what you just said. He says, you can think about the future, just don't write it down. Because when you write it down, you're like, that's planning, and that's think. You know, just think about it. Don't write it down. Writing it down is too formal. Just skip it. Think about it, move on. So I've always liked that idea, too.
That being said, I'll tell you that I think Google Wave is going to be really fun to watch.
Yeah, Wave is interesting. I don't know what it's going to end up being. I think what we're all seeing today is not anything like what it's really going to be. And like, there's going to be a killer app sort of for Wave. I don't think it's anywhere near.
I think you're right.
You know? Yeah, there's going to be something. I don't know what it's going to be, but what it is today is not as exciting as what it will be, because it will be very, very cool. But right now, it's so early, I don't think anyone really knows what the hell to do with it. But someone's going to find that thing that's going to make it big.
I mean, it's a very good point.
Let me jump into this one here. HYSBT6000, how can I get into book writing? You know, sitting down to write a book is a lot of work, and it's intimidating. So what I would suggest you do is just, if you're going to write, you should just blog. So start blogging. For example, Getting Real, our first book, just was basically compiled from about 100 blog posts we put together over the previous couple of years. We didn't know we were writing a book at the time. We were just blogging about stuff that mattered to us. And then we kind of looked at that, called it, polished it up, and turned it into a book. So you don't need to be thinking about yourself as writing a book. You can just think of yourself as writing, and then eventually you have enough material to make into a book.
That's awesome. Yeah.
I mean, how are you going to write your book, right, Gary? You dictated it? How'd that work out for you?
I totally audioed the whole thing. I can't write, you know? So I let blogging go. So I just ripped, you know, for like 3-4 hour sessions like this to a ghostwriter. And that's why everybody loves the book so much, because it sounds like me, because I wouldn't even let her do anything. I'm just like, please just fix the grammar, you know?
So that's how, I'm just curious, that's how the process went. You kind of dictated it, and then she pretty much wrote what you said, huh?
She recorded it and just kind of like asked me questions. What was great about it is we caught this crazy rhythm where, you know, she doesn't know this stuff, so she asked me some really good noob questions that let me expand on it. So, you know, I learned so much about this book, Fried. Here's what I know. What Super Freakonomics and Malcolm do, and I've started learning more again because I don't read it hurt me in this scenario, I so know how to make my next book like the craziest book ever. Because all people really want is maybe 4 to 5 examples deeper. I have some really interesting thoughts in general.
Well, I think the most interesting thing that's going to happen in books for the next 10 years, forget, like, here we go with my predictions, I don't make them, but here, I'll make one anyway. Forget the digital stuff or whatever, that's going to happen too, but shorter books. Short books are where it's going to be at. 100 pages or less. If I was a publisher right now, I would start a whole new imprint called 100 and Less, and it would only be books for 100 pages or less. That's all you really need to explain something. That's all people really want to read anyway. And if it takes you longer than that, it's probably just filler. So I think there's a huge opportunity for someone to do 100 and less books.
Fried, I really, really, really almost did something so fucking insane, and I regret it every day. I have a chapter in my book, Chapter 9, and people are freaking about it, right? Almost made Chapter 9 a book.
Just one chapter.
Uh-huh. And guess what?
I have the book in front of me downstairs. I'm going to go get it because I bought 12 copies of it, and I've been handing it out to friends, but I kept a few for myself. So I'm running downstairs right now to go see Chapter 9.
I think you're going to like it. I think you're going to like where I was going to go with this.
All right, hang on. 12, 10, 9. Yes. I love that.
I swear to God, I was going to convince HarperCollins to let me print a book that had 100 pages in it, but there was only going to be one page that had one word on it, and that was going to be the entire book.
That's awesome. You should do it. They'll do it. You're magic. They'll do it for you.
I know, but I already used that, and it's like kind of what I believe. You know, I can't artificially come up with something else like that. It could have been such a hysteria. Could you imagine? It could have gotten crazy. It could have been one of the greatest moves of all time. Could you imagine if that would have worked? Like, that's the kind of book, like, corporations would have bought, like, 900,000 copies of, and it was a one word.
Right.
It could have been big.
You know,
I fucked up.
That. No, you didn't fuck. Come on. You didn't fuck up, please.
But, I mean, if I had a book.
So far? Do you know how many books you sold so far?
Over 100,000.
Holy shit. That's
huge. It's doing really well. I mean, it's doing really, really well. And as people are reading it, it's getting more and more word of mouth and less it needs me to push it. So it's getting interesting, you know?
The thing I really liked about what you did, and I think it's a good lesson for every author out there, is whenever you wrote a negative review on Amazon, you were jumping in there, you were leaving a comment on that person's review, saying, give me a call, let's talk about it. Like, I have not seen another author ever do that. And I think it's a great lesson.
Thanks, man. I mean, I respect people when they don't think, and, you know, I give so much love to the people that love me. I've got to respect people that have negative thoughts, and you've got to listen to people, and you can learn a lot from that. And, you know, I have enough self-esteem, and my skin is thick enough, you know?
Right. No question. But it's a great thing. I mean, we're going to do that. I learned a lot from that. I think it's a great idea. Get in there and engage people. And the thing is, when you actually, you know, when you say, hey, I respect your point of view, we may not share the same point of view, but I respect it. People respect you back in a way that you it's just another, it's like a different type of understanding that comes about when someone disagrees with you and you respectfully disagree back. Like they gain a whole deeper level of understanding about what you're really about. Because until then, they're just kind of, you know, they have a vision in their head about who you are and what you believe and that whole sort of thing. And if you just come clean with them and say, this is what I think, and thanks for leaving the feedback, I mean, it really changes the whole dynamic. I think it's super valuable for authors to do that.
All right, cool. Guys, guess what? I've got a screenshot. Somebody just tweeted it. Reed, are you in the chat? Like, do you see the chat?
I'm in the chat.
Like, you guys,
there it is.
You guys, all right, here it is. You've got to look at this. How sick is this?
Holy shit. So you got the TiVo logo and everything next to you.
No, forget about that. Like, the homepage. This is the homepage of TiVo for everybody in the world.
Do you get any stats on, like, how many people are watching yourself through TiVo? It'd be so interesting to see that. I know you don't watch analytics, but...
They're going to give me stats over the next quarter. I mean, people... I mean, it's going to be absurd. Absurd. How many people... I mean, this is like, you can't make this up. Like, this is like absurd. I don't know
how to line that up. Did they do that, or did you talk to them, or did they just do it, or what? How'd that happen?
I met them. This is, you know what? This is textbook. Everybody should listen to this. How did I do it? Here's how. Pumping out fucking awesome content and working my ass off, right? Nothing happens without that, right? That's how. But taking a step further, they came to a live event in New York, in San Francisco, where I was talking, and then I met them, shook some hands. They're like, we really like your content here at TiVo. And I put on the fucking sales pitch. I'm like, what can we do? What can we do that's different? You know, right away, just went for it. Here are the TiVo decision makers, and I put my teeth into them. And it took 6 months, and now I've got basically something I couldn't even imagine happening.
The lesson there really is, like, you don't ask, you don't get. You know, just go for it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, No Luck Murphy, the landslide begins. You know, No Luck Murphy, it's funny. The landslide thing is very interesting to me. I mean, that's how I'm kind of looking at it right now.
That's badass, man. Congratulations on that. That's pretty huge.
Like, and you know what's too bad? I don't know where they're at these days, but, you know, now a lot of us have DVRs or what have you, but can you imagine a year and a half ago, a lot more people had it, you know? Oh.
At TiVo? Yeah. I don't know how they're doing.
Coder Pat says, what do you think that TiVo spot is worth if you had to buy it? It's got to be ungodly. Ungodly. Because there's millions of TiVo units out there. I mean, it's the homepage. Like, it's like getting the homepage. It's like better than Google, because I don't even go to Google's homepage. I go through my Firefox top right corner. Like, everybody has to go there.
Yeah.
It's pretty epic. You know?
All right, let's see here. Yeah, no, totally, man. I'd like to see, I don't know if you can find out, but I would just be curious to see how many people view the videos through there.
Yeah, I'll let you know. I'll let everybody know.
Yeah, you can find out. How do you guys train new employees and make sure they get off to a fast, productive start? I think you've got to, like, and this is something Gary was getting to earlier, it's like, you've got to work closely with new people, and you've got to rub off on them, basically. And they've got to rub off on you, too, because there's always something you can learn from someone else who's new. Don't ever think that you're the only one who can teach someone something. So someone you hire someone, there's something that for you to learn there as well. So we tend to, when the people are working in Chicago, at least, if it's like a new designer, for example, we'll work really closely. I'll work really closely with them on a new project.
Like with Jamie, our new designer, we redid all the marketing sites, 37signals.com, Basecamp, HiRise, all those sites together over about 4 months, and just went back and forth and back and forth. And I infected him with some of my thinking, and he infected me with some of his, and that's kind of the best way to do it. We don't have like a training program or anything like that. We just do the work. It's the best training.
GB, in the is this call going to be downloadable later? I don't know, Devin, because I am recording it, but I don't know what that means. Is Marcus in here? Like, I don't really know. I'm not sure. Let me answer. We'll let you know.
Marcus, I think he mentioned that it would be.
I am recording it. I did hit the record. I don't know what that means, but contact. My wife and two kids come first, so I won't crush it until after 9 p.m. I exercise, eat right, and don't smoke. Any other tips on how to bring your energy up without resorting to caffeine? CoderPath, I'm going to tell you how I get my energy up. I look around and I recognize that I live in an amazing country, that I have the health of the people I love, and I just don't think people realize. I've come to realize very recently, Fried, that I'm driven not by the fact that I'm an immigrant like I used to think. I'm driven by gratitude.
Hmm.
I'm grateful.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
Coder, my energy's through the roof because of gratitude.
Yeah, my trainer is from Poland, and he came here about 10 years ago. And he is probably the happiest guy I know for the same reason, I think, that you are happy and love doing what you're doing. Is he couldn't have his life anywhere else. In Poland,
right.
He couldn't do shit. Couldn't do shit.
Right.
And, you know, I was fortunate enough to be born here, but I've got relatives who, you know, close relatives who weren't, and they come here and they love it. And it's great. I love running into people who appreciate what they have. And it's hard to find that. The best place to find that, I think, is actually to talk to immigrants, because they really get what the hell's going on here.
I agree.
Let's see. I'm looking for a question here. We've got about 20 minutes left here. We should do some rapid-fire questions, like no answers longer than 10 seconds.
Great idea, Fried. Let's do it.
All right.
Favorite product? R&W root beer.
Oh, shit. I'm
a Ford guy.
Sirius Radio.
Nice.
I love Sirius Radio.
I'm in talks with them right now, Fried, for a show. Favorite blog? Favorite blog? Believe it or not, my favorite blog is TechCrunch. It is.
I like Andrew Sullivan.
Will Android beat iPhone? I actually have a funny feeling it will. A weird feeling. I feel that Apple's getting very weird Microsoft-y to me, and I think mobile's going to be the new playing field, and they're very closed. They're very closed.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm sort of coming around to that in some way, but not for a while. I think Apple's experience is fantastic. So I think that they have a huge, huge advantage there. But I do think if they remain sort of standoffish over time, that's going to erode their market share, just like, you know, basically did with the Mac OS originally. But it's going to be very, very hard to beat Apple in mobile. Very, very hard. Because the typical mobile experience, especially with installing software, is really bad. It's really poor. A lot of things don't work. And Apple has really nailed that experience. But we'll see. We'll see where it goes. That was a long 10-second answer. Sorry.
Is 37 Signals looking to go into the mobile space, Reed?
We're building a high-rise app for the iPhone, but we're not touching the Basecamp market. There's already a bunch of great Basecamp apps on the iPhone, but high-rise, we haven't really found a great one yet, so we're building our own. It should be out hopefully within the next few months.
Is 37 Signals going into HR space?
I don't even know what that means. Human relations?
I think high-rise, right?
Human resources?
Or
I don't really know. Yeah, I don't know what that means, I guess. What the HR space would be, so I can't answer that one, sorry.
I'm a boxer.
I'm a boxer brief guy. I'm kind of in the middle, I guess.
Nice. I don't read books. Fried, can you give Servito some books?
A couple books I would recommend. For business, I would recommend Maverick, a book I talked about earlier by Ricardo Semler. It's probably the best business book I've ever read. It's just totally different. You're not going to hear this kind of stuff anywhere else. Great book. I also like a book called Against All Odds by James Dyson, the guy who made the Dyson vacuum. It's a great story about believing in your own ideas and being incredibly persistent and sticking with your own ideas and not being afraid to just go for it. He was rejected by every, he tried to sell his ideas to every possible vacuum manufacturer. They all said, you're fucking crazy, and they all stole his idea. He had to fight every dollar he had in the courts to get his patent to be approved and to be able to fight these guys. This is just an individual who was fighting big corporations. He was right. They were wrong. It finally came out that he was right, and he's built a great business on top of that. But it's a fantastic story, especially people who love design. And those are the only two I'll share right now. Also, there's a book called Crush It. I don't know if you've heard of it. I would definitely read that. A chance.
All right, rapid fire. How did you start marketing Basecamp initially?
How about some questions for Gary? I feel like Gary's getting pushed out here, man. Come on.
I'm enjoying this.
Go ahead. Let me just give you that one real quick. We used to be a design firm, so we wrote a blog, Signal vs. Noise, which is the same blog we write today, and we were, you know, fairly well known in the web design industry. So when we built Basecamp, we initially just marketed to the people we knew, which is web designers. So all the marketing was sort of tailored towards web designers because that was the industry and the people we knew. But again, we didn't buy ads. It was just all word of mouth, all sharing, all design decision posts, all sorts of things starting with our blog.
I'm using an iPhone. Is the production companies to the internet not exclusively survive for Vito's, but I do think television's going in an interesting place. Check out what Boxy's doing. The best new wine is for a newbie is probably a German Riesling. Target year for the Jets is 2035. VaynerMedia is basically helping the NHL and the New York Jets tell stories in social media. We give them strategy. I'm a sherry guy, big bot. Favorite chain is the Kimpton. All cookies, look yourself in the mirror and don't lie to yourself about your passion. Those are some of my answers. That's some rapid fire.
Hey, Gary, what's it like to work for the Jets? I mean, you just have so much love for that brand, that company, that family, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, so that would have been really weird, Fried, because I was scared shitless that the games would feel different to me. As a matter of fact, right before the first game of the season, I looked at AJ dead seriously and said, if this doesn't feel the same, we're letting them go as a client.
Right.
Like, flat out, because I love it so much. I was like, it was pretty funny, but it does still feel the same. I mean, I worked for the Jets, you know, with VaynerMedia, and I tweeted a couple days ago, you know, after Sanchez had a horrible game, you know, fuck you, Sanchez, on Twitter. That was my tweet. And so I'm a fan first, you know?
That's cool. Good that you're
I don't put any milk or sugar into my tea, big butt. Right, Jace?
Yeah, no coffee and no milk and sugar and tea. Tea straight up, always. I don't drink coffee.
You guys be willing?
Occasionally might drink coffee, but very rarely.
Reed, the question is, would you guys be willing to be a guest on This Week in Tech with Leo?
Of course.
Me as well?
Leo's great. I've done the show a few times. Leo is one of the true quality broadcasters online. Great guy.
I agree. I have
and
so
Amber's
much respect.
Great, too. Amber, of course, is great.
Yeah, Amber's really good. I like her a lot.
Yeah.
80s, 90s cartoon. My favorite cartoon from the 80s was something called Laugh Olympics. A lot of people don't know what it is. It was, like, this amazing cartoon where all the different, like, cartoon families had a competition against each other, like the Hanna-Barbera people versus the bad guys versus the, you know, it was crazy. It was this amazing show. Reed, did you have that? Does anybody in this room know what the last Olympics was?
I don't think I remember seeing it. I used to watch, you know, I watched all the classics, Tom and Jerry, Woody Woodpecker, and the Flintstones, and, you know, all that shit. I don't remember that, but I'll tell you what, my favorite cartoon sort of segment was, like, Home of the Future. I think it was, like, part of Woody Woodpecker or Tom and Jerry, where they would do, like, a 50s-style, I guess it was in the 50s, like, black-and-white cartoon of what it was going to be like in the future, sort of Jetson style. I don't know if you ever saw those, but they were great.
What were they called?
It was like something of the future, like Home of the Future or House of the Future. It was like a little sort of interlude between like two cartoons, like a cartoon commercial sort of. I'll see if I can find any of them online. Let me look real quick. They were great.
I just linked Laugh Olympics. I just found it. It was called Scooby's All-Star Laugh Olympics. Joseph Barbera and William Hanna captured 80s, 90s. Laugh Olympics. It was the Yogi Yahooies versus the Scooby Doobies versus the Really Rhymes. I remember this so firmly. Best cartoon ever.
I can't find it. I'll see if I can find it later. All right. Let's see here. Ren and Stimpy was fucking great. I loved Ren and Stimpy. That was one of the great cartoons.
Cookie says, how do you know to jump into an idea? How do you evaluate? We talked about that earlier. I like to wait. If it's sticking with me for 6 months, I love all my ideas, but the ones that stick around in my mind for 6 months are the ones I usually like to jump into.
That's a good one, too. That's kind of how we do it. If something sticks around, we go.
Oh, like Ryan, I believe in the long tail. I think the long tail is much longer than people think.
Yeah, I mean, I think it makes sense in summary. I don't really know. It's one of those terms that I don't really know what it means other than, I mean, of course, like there's a lot of people who are into a lot of different things. So I don't really know what it means to believe in it. I don't think anyone doesn't believe in it. Whether or not you can make it work is a whole other story. I mean, I don't know what percentage of sales Amazon or Netflix comes from the, quote, long tail. But, anyway, I'm kind of rambling about it. I don't really know what to say.
I actually am very interested in the massive low-hanging fruit, the byproducts, as you call it, Creed. That's just fascinating.
Yep. Totally. I agree with that completely. Let's see. that's funny. Oh, that's kind of a cool idea. BikBot, you should write a book of all the things that you don't do. Like, all the product ideas you had, all the things that you wanted to do that you never got around to. That's kind of cool. Although I did that
in Crush It. Five business ideas I won't get to.
At the end. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. There's like five ideas, right?
I did that because I wanted to see how well that was liked because I was going to write a book, 101 Business Ideas I'll Never Get To, and lay out 101 businesses that would be successful.
Yeah, Appendix B in your book. Got it.
Uh-huh. By the way, I'm linking up this classic
business. Here's something I cannot believe has not been done yet. I don't know why. When you're waiting for your bags at an airport by the baggage claim.
Tell me this. Guys, pay attention to what Freed's about to say. I love this. Go.
So you're sitting there, standing there, waiting for your fucking bags. You don't want to go to Starbucks. You don't want to go somewhere else because you don't want to miss your bag. There should be people with carts coming around to the baggage claim area selling you stuff, water, Coke, whatever it is, magazines, gum. You're like this amazing captive audience who wants something to drink. You just got off a plane, whatever, but you don't want to leave the area. So I cannot believe there are not portable sort of on-cart kiosk-like things trying to sell you stuff while you're waiting for your bags. Huge missed opportunity.
Huge. I totally agree.
Let's see here. And you can charge double retail. I mean, it's just so many great ideas, and people are just sitting there waiting, and they're thirsty, and they're tired, and they got bad breath. Like, all these things you can be capitalizing on. It's just unbelievable.
Great. What would you do to change college and school? Do you remember us at that big Omaha?
Oh, God. God.
We ripped college
first. So broken. School is so fucking broken. I wouldn't
To change it, I don't know. I would say everyone needs to be an apprentice. I mean, like, that's really, it's not even the future of education. It's the past of education. That's how you really learn how to do something, is you do it with someone else who knows how to do it already. That's really what you ought to be doing. Not sitting in classrooms talking about theoretical crap. You know, get out there and be an apprentice. I'd love to see more apprenticeships.
I totally agree.
Yeah. But yeah, it's such a busted, that model's so busted, and it's so expensive, and it's such a waste of money and time. 4 years of your life, here's the thing, you're paying for tuition for 4 years. 4 years in your, you know, your late teens, early 20s. You could be working and getting paid to learn.
Listen, Reed, I had a Harvard MBA and a Darden MBA interned with me at VaynerMedia this summer, and they email me and hit me up on AIM every day saying they can't fathom how much they learned compared to what they're paying to learn now, and how they would just, they're devastated, and just how eye-opening it was, and how pissed they are that they're spending all that money in school right now.
It's just sad. Don't you feel bad? I mean, I feel bad for people who think that that's the answer, and they're going into debt. I mean, why would you want to go into debt to start your life? It's just such a bad idea. So it's too bad. There are some schools that are coming around to that, but anyway.
I agree, man. So
people are asking if we have interns. We don't currently have interns. We might do something next year. We don't have enough office space to have interns, but maybe next year.
Coder Path is right when he says university is like a conference. It's not about the content. It's about the networking. The problem is the cost is so exuberant.
Right. That's the problem.
Yep.
We've got two people at 37 Signals who homeschool their kids, and their kids are wicked smart, and parents are happy. I mean, I think that's a pretty interesting model, too. I think there just should be all sorts of new models for education. It's unbelievable to me that there's kind of like two models. There's public schools and private schools, and like that's it. And there's no like, it just seems so old. I don't even know what else there would be, but it just seems so old. And when people look at homeschoolers and they think that it's weird, I think that's really sad too. Why is it weird that you want to teach your kids something? Like, there's got to be
funny?
So many different ways to teach things. Go ahead.
I'm seriously thinking about starting a school.
That'd be great. You should totally start a school. You know what there should be? There should be
in like 20 years. Absolutely. I want business classes for six-year-olds. Like, Reed,
absolutely.
I would be unstoppable if I knew more about, you know, wills and the stock market and just a lot of taxes. Like, why the fuck did I not get taught that? I would have come out like a ninja.
It's unreal. Like, you go to school. You don't learn about insurance. You don't learn about lawyers. You don't learn about trust. You don't learn about will. You don't learn about any of the things that you actually kind of need to know to live a normal adult life in a modern society with money. And you know, you don't know this shit. You're not taught it. And you're taught it in a way that's not exciting. Go ahead.
Devin Koshal, I agree with you about socializing. And that's the one big thing. I think you need to socialize with other people. That's the big thing. There's a huge stigma there. I like the socializing, so I agree.
I think this is part of the problem, that people think that like homeschool kids aren't social. There are huge networks of other kids in the area who are homeschooled, neighbors and friends, and I just don't buy that. Like, I know there's a stigma that, you know, people who are taught at home don't know how to make friends. It's just not true. It's not the experience that I've had with people I know who've gone through that. So I think we need to lighten up about it.
You know? I agree with you. I agree with you totally. I've seen the same thing. Like, one of AJ's best friends was homeschooled. Somebody's asking, last time I took a vacation, I took one in April of last year, and I'm taking one with Lizzie in the last week of December this year, and then we're taking another one in March. We also had a baby back in May 31st, so that was a big thing. So, but yeah, I mean, I'll vacation. I mean, you know what, dude? I'm fucking vacationing right now. You know? I mean, when I vacation,
sort of my answer.
I vacation, quote unquote vacation, I freak out. I think too many ideas. When I'm not working, I'm thinking of too many business ideas. Lizzie always makes fun of me because I'll always be like laying there and I'll be like, Lizzie, I'll be right back. And I'll stand up and I'll go walk to the water because we like to go to the beach usually. And I'll start picking at my head. Freed, when I have a big idea, I actually like scratch my scalp and eat it. And I'll just sit there and like walk the beachfront and scratch my scalp and come back and be like, I got it. You know, like that's just how I go.
I haven't really taken a true vacation for 10 years. 2000. Yeah, 2000 was the last. I went to Europe for a month. That was the last true vacation I've taken. I've gone a few places for 3 or 4 days here and there, but I can't. I like the micro vacation thing. I like the 3 days away and back in the business. I'm antsy when I'm not working, when I'm not able to perform on something that I want to do. Like, vacations kind of bore me at the end of the day. So I try not to take long ones, but take more short ones. And lately, you know, I've been going up to Wisconsin. I got this place up in Wisconsin last year, and almost every weekend this summer and spring I was up in Wisconsin for just 3-day weekends, and it's really all I need to just kind of recharge, just a few days off.
So, guys, I need to cut like a minute or two early because they're trying to close up Wine Library, and I feel bad that I'm holding them here, and I think this was... I'm sure everybody will be okay if we wrap up like 3 minutes early, but I really hope that I could see I could see people are commenting already. I don't know. This felt really good, Jason. I feel like we got to do something like this more often.
No, this is a blast. I mean, 3 hours went by like nothing. I can't believe we've been on the phone for 3 hours.
I know, it's crazy. Yeah. And you know what's great? I love it. Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead. I just saw a few going by. What happened to the seed conference? We're planning on doing another one next year. I'll let you guys know. Do you have a tractor? Yeah, I bought a tractor, which is kind of fun. I bought a tractor this fall, and I've been mowing the fields up at the farm.
CoderPath is our first customer for our paid podcast. We'll let you know. And there are people who bought 5 books of each, and we are doing a conference in Chicago next year, right, Jace?
That's correct. I don't know when it's going to be or where specifically, but it'll probably be, you know, springtime, maybe April, something like that, maybe May. We'll definitely get in touch with everyone and let people know when we have more specs on that.
Yes, if anybody buys 4 more books of each and sends the email to the email there, you can definitely get a ticket to the Chicago thing. So feel free to do that if you're interested. Jason and I will be appreciative of the extra 4 books each sold and would love to see you. I don't know about you, but this was one of the most enjoyable things I've done. And I love, I'll be honest with you, and I haven't really slept in 6 weeks, so I feel like the next time around I'll be even better.
This was a blast. No, I really had a good time, enjoyed it. I hope everyone else who's on the line did too, and I hope we can do more of these.
I feel like people got more help than normal because of this, you know?
You think so?
I do. I feel like we really got specific. We could have been even more specific next time. It was such a small group. I love that. We should create something like the Jason and Gary 99 and have like, you know, like a podcast once every month for just 99 people, and that's it. That's all they can get in. And then next year.
Let me throw this at you. Actually, it's the last idea maybe of the day here. Is this something I've been thinking a little bit about, and I want to write something about this. I feel like moments have been lost. The idea that there can be a group of just 30 people who participate in something and no one else knows about it. It seems like today everything is downloadable and shareable and everyone shares in the experience and everyone's photos are online and everyone's, you know, when this call's over, we'll upload it and tens of thousands of people can listen to it. Like, whatever happened to this idea that only these 30 people who were here today or 50 or 80 or whatever it was, they're the only ones who had this experience. I think that is totally underrated. I think that's the way it used to be, and it's gone away from that, and I'd love to get back to it.
You know what's funny? We should do something where it's like 37 people, and that's it. 37 people, and they should pay. Here's what I think should happen. 37 people, $3,700 a year, once a month. It's worth $300, and we do it for like 3.7 hours or something. I mean, we can do something really funny. But you're right, and like nobody can. And nobody can
take doing that next year.
I love it. Crush 37. You know, I VaynerMedia is about to launch a product. We're going to call it like VM30, Freed. And we're going to take 30 companies. They'll be exclusive to their space. We're going to be doing something pretty epic. I'd like you to come and speak at one of the events.
Oh, I'd love to. You know that. Yeah, speaking of
this, amazing. Everybody's looking at me. I'm just very thankful and humbled for everybody that was in here, and thanks for supporting the book. Freed, you are amazing. Only a few people I feel I can hang like this and enjoy it as much as I did, and thanks so much, and I will adopt the company.
Thanks for inviting me, by the way. Yeah.
No problem, man, and thanks so much to everybody. Freed? Freed? He's gone? Freed? 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 Guys, thank you so much. This was absurd. I'm just like laughing at everybody who wasn't part of this. I feel like they're suckers, and I feel like you guys just fucking crushed it. I mean, are you kidding me? What was my book's like $12? Freed's, I don't know. 12, I mean, am I right in thinking that most people spent like $10 an hour for this? I mean, that's just insane. Freed? 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 I think we should all tweet out. Freed? 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 Guys, thank you so much. This was an absolute blast. I'm laughing my ass off with you guys. You're all part of the family. I hope I get to hug you and shake your hand and thank you for the support you've shown me and my family. It's something I'll never take for granted. I don't give a fuck if I have 8.5 billion followers. Thank you so much. So, so much. Take care of yourselves and your families. I love you guys. Freed? 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 Coder Path, good job. Nice job. Good work. There we go. Texan. Freed? Freed? Freed!